Good one. 9:05, we will get started. We'll call to the order the TCQ Tax Relief for Pollution Control Properties Advisory Committee. And I want to recognize, I haven't done the head count, I know John Nichols sent an email this morning, he has fever, and I think he got back in bed. So I believe all the rest of us are here. So, and the public policy, I state this before every meeting, is we welcome comments from the public. If you'll fill out a registration, I think there's a form out there on the table probably, and give it to somebody, TCQ staff, and then get it up here. And you're welcome to come up here anytime, and even more than one time. Just be aware that we need to manage time, so we'll get through all of our issues that are on the agenda. So any general comments from the committee before we get started? All right, we'll rock right along then. Item 2A, change in ownership. There's a couple of items here, the reason I put this on here. One, I want to talk about just the standard change in ownership. I've got some feedback from people that say it's a little bit more of an onerous process than they think necessary to just simply change the name of a company on a use determination. And the thought is, I've heard some feedback also, the air permit, and the staff, please correct me if I'm wrong, that the air permit is basically a notification of the name change. And I would think it'd be reasonable if there's some attestation that the new owner is continuing to use the property for pollution control. But beyond that, I personally don't think we need to go through an approval process just to change the name. So, and by the way, I had it from me earlier, 1710-8, I think it is the rule that does require for an application. D8, okay, 1710-D8. So any discussion on this?
Sure.
Well, I don't want it to be automatic, because we want to make sure it's still being used for the same thing.
Right, and that's why I said that, to attest that it is still pollution control property.
And if things, how would you say, say something was once granted, and the ownership changes, but it's something that they would no longer grant today, then
that gets into a philosophy versus creating a big administrative burden. I mean, what's the balance? And I don't know from the staff's perspective of how difficult it would be to review every change of ownership.
Is this something we can change by rule? I think this is basic tax, property tax law. All property tax exemptions have to be reestablished when you transfer property.
Which occurs when, with the appraisal. I mean, as I understand the law, you do have to submit to the appraisal district an application when you change ownership. And this would not change that.
Sure, to reestablish the facts around that exemption. This would be creating a even more of a special circumstance around this exemption that we don't do on any other property tax exemption, of saying that the facts that establish the basis of an exemption pass along with the property. We don't do that in property tax administration anywhere else. Am I correct? And the comptroller's office is here. I also think this is a matter of state law. You're going to have to change the statute. And if we want to get into negotiating some changes to the statute, we have a long list.
The big difference is, in a lot of local property taxes, you don't have a state agency as involved in it as for this.
Which is maybe something that could be reevaluated. I mean, if we're going to use that to establish, to go against all the tenants of property tax administration.
No, I don't think anybody's suggesting we go against all the tenants of property tax administration.
Well, passing, saying that the facts that establish a exempt status can now transfer with property when it is transferred, does go against the tenets of how we administer property taxes in the state.
My only goal, and I don't have any bet in this game right now, my company's not planning on changing ownership or anything that I know of. All I'm trying to just to help the process where it doesn't take as long to get to the TCEQ process. That's all.
Yeah.
Based on the feedback I'm getting, and that's I'm just carrying it forward. Now, is there a better way? Maybe that's the better way to ask the question. Is there a more efficient way to handle changes of ownership?
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Bernardo Garcia. I don't think there is a more efficient way. I don't think that Chapter 11 of the tax code requires...
Yes, Bernardo Garcia. I don't think that the process under Chapter 11 is really meant to be efficient. It's not supposed to be because you're transferring a tax burden. Any type of change the TCEQ attempts to make regarding the change of ownership, you're actually doing something that even the legislature would not do for any other charity or any other exemption. If you sell your home to somebody else, they have to requalify for that homestead exemption. If a church sells their property,
and the same here.
Well, exactly, requalify, not just change the name on the property. They have to requalify that's what they're using the property for.
And I wouldn't suggest not applying to the CAD. I mean, you still have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but the thing is, they have to requalify that's what they're using the property for. I'm a little passionate about this particular issue because we have at least three companies in Harris County that have transferred ownership to a bank, for example, and as a way of getting financing, but they've transferred lock, stock, and barrel to the bank. And the bank is the owner of the equipment. The company, the refinery, the chemical company, whatever it is that they're doing, all they're doing is just leasing it back. There's no equitable ownership.
That's a standard leaseback, or...
It's not a standard leaseback. I'll tell you why it's not a standard leaseback.
Okay.
Because there's nothing at the end of the lease that says, at the end of 10 or 20 years, we'll buy it back for a dollar. That's a standard leaseback. It's not. You know, and the reason why is because, and it's very clear to me, because I've been doing tax law for 20 years almost. That's why I'm such a nerd on this issue. But the thing about it is that the bank is doing it because they don't want to stand in line in case that refinery goes belly up. They want to be able to walk into bankruptcy court and say, you know what, that refinery went into bankruptcy, but that property is ours. And all they're doing is leasing it. They're not the owner. We are.
So the motivation is not financing.
It may be financing, but it's also financing to get something that they otherwise would not be entitled to. So they come to TCEQ and say, oh, that's just a name change. But when they run into bankruptcy court, they're saying, oh, no, we're the owners. The chemical company is not the owner. Look at these documents. There's no equitable ownership. We're not going to sell it back to them for a dollar. It's not a lease back. We are the owners, and all they're doing is leasing it from
us. How do they air permit that? Are all the permits under the bank?
Well, the thing is, we don't know because all they're doing is changing the name, you see.
I mean, how do y'all?
And it's still the same pollution control property. Presumably. Used for pollution control.
Presumably, all they're doing is just filing a name change, and it really isn't. I mean, they're changing lock, stock, and barrel. And what's happening, folks, fundamentally, is that you have a bank or a finance company or a group of investors that is diversifying, and instead of just loaning money, they're now in the refinery business. That's not really what they're doing. And they're relying on what the lessee is doing to get that qualification. And that brings up another specter, you know. And that specter is the on-site requirement. You now have a bank or a financing group that is controlling pollution not in their bank lobby but someplace else. because it's not their facility. You follow what I'm saying? That's the specter.
The operator is...
Exactly. You see what I'm saying? All they're doing is providing a service. I can understand what the company's trying to do, what both of them are trying to do. Maybe they need money. That's a problem. But instead of just doing a deed of trust where the bank is just a regular mortgage holder, I can understand that. I mean, nothing would change. But the bank wants their cake and eat it too. So they want to be able to loan money but still be the primary owner so that they don't have to stand in line in case that company goes belly up.
So if there was like a some provision in the contract that says they could buy it at the end of the term for a buck or whatever, then it would be a different situation?
Well, I mean, that's generally what we do with homesteads, with contracts for deeds and with some other arrangements that have gone through. Correct me if I'm wrong, Rome, but I think that would be correct.
So it'd be a different situation.
It'd be a different situation. But in the situations that we're seeing, that's not the case. They're selling lock, stock, and barrel in the company, in the facility, to this bank, and then the bank just enters into a lease. And the reason is very simple. They want to be, and they want to be able to protect themselves in case the company goes belly up.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out the operator, how much responsibility for ownership that they have. You know, because like you said, if the permits are everything in their name,
and they were in their name.
They were in their name. No, I'm not talking the air. I'm talking air permits.
Here you have a problem of who's responsible for the property taxes.
Exactly.
Who is it?
That's the question.
Yeah. I guess, and, you know, it's like that, you know, if you're a lessee, you have the responsibility or the rights to protest in behalf of the owner.
Well, you can protest the tax, but that doesn't mean you can protest and grant and get the exemption granted. No other exemption under Chapter 11 allows the lessee to get an exemption. None.
Now, Chapter 11, no.
There is
312 does.
Yeah, well, but that's a little different situation. The legislature passed that. The legislature had hearings and decided what would be the economic impact of allowing that. The only time where you have equitable interest is when a government entity comes in and leases a building with the intent to buy it. The legislature has said, we're going to let the government get the government exemption. But that's a government. When you're talking about private entities, it just doesn't exist. It's not there. And Chapter 11 is onerous. It's supposed to be onerous. It's not supposed to be efficient. It's supposed to put people back through the meat grinder because you're transferring a tax burden from one set of property owners to another when you remove that. And just like anything else, and just to repeat myself a little bit here, any other entity that's getting any other kind of an exemption, if they sell the property to another entity that's doing the same thing, that entity has to requalify. And they have to go through the process to make sure that they're making the representations that, yes, we are doing this, yes, we're upkeeping this, yes, we are responsible. You see, otherwise, you're going to have a situation where you have two people pointing the finger at each other. You have the lessee, well, we're not the owner. You have the lessor saying, well, but they're the ones doing it. Well, what's the permit for? I mean, who's feeding you to hold to the fire when the thing blows up? You see what I'm saying?
In that situation, they certify. I mean, take the homestead exemption. I mean, that process, they've got to sign a sworn statement that basically comports with the regulations that...
Let me tell you about sworn statements. In Harris County, sworn statements, we can't take those to the DA's office. They won't accept them. You know why? Because the DA's office has told us, and they've told other appraisal districts, let's see, you removed the exemption, right?
Right.
Did you roll back on it? Well, maybe a year or so. Oh, well, that's the penalty. So they won't prosecute people for executing a false or a fraudulent certification.
So it's not a crime. So is more required of them? Does the
only,
law, I mean,
only if we put them through the meat grinder.
Right, so to Don's point, I mean, when you mm-hmm. made these statements, I'm just trying to take mm-hmm. one thing at a time. If the way this works for other exemptions, take homestead, is we force people to certify, but with some concerns about enforceability, duly noted, but are they required to do more than certify?
No. No, it's not even under oath. It's not a notarized statement as well.
The point is that when you transfer property, right. You start the exemption application process anew.
And you certify.
There's no special exemption process
or exemption transference process, because a piece of property had an exempt status under a previous owner doesn't mean
the new person has to come in, put their name on the line, swear to it, check off all the things that they're eligible for.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure I understand how that's different than what he just explained. If you have somebody certifying that they're changing ownership, we know the rules, you can put a bunch of stuff in the certification. I'm not making a proposal.
Okay, wait a minute. There's a big difference. If you've got a homestead right now that's being used as for the home of a senior citizen, they qualify for different exemptions than a straight homestead. So they have to come in and re-qualify. They come in, I lived at this house January 1, right. I'm under 65, and this is my homestead.
Right.
So when you do that, they qualify for a different exemption.
Sure. But the way they've done that, and I did it myself, I remember that, is, you know, Gus and Essie May don't live there anymore. Right. I'm certifying that I get a homestead exemption, but not for the same reasons and not to the same extent. And so you certify that. I'm just trying to understand what beyond a certification is asked of applicants.
Well,
and I'm confused. What could we require here to satisfy those concerns?
Well, because there's a local application that you file for the TCQ. I mean,
right.
It's a local, and you have to. There's check boxes on there that you have to go through for ownership.
But they
cost.
Come here first.
I understand that.
They come here first.
But I'm saying you have to certify. At the county level.
But that application has to have a use determination.
The use determination is given to owner ABC, not to XYZ.
Yes.
And at that point, they're going to have to requalify from the beginning.
Exactly. And I don't interpret what Bob's saying as saying we wouldn't do that. And in fact, isn't this program actually doubling up? Because it's requiring a certification to this agency, and then you've also got to go to certify you all.
Hey, anytime they want to come to me first, I'd be glad to do that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I'm just saying that is there really anything more that they would be asked if they weren't in Prop 2 and they were just in a homestead exemption? They're asked to certify compliance with a certain set of rules. And isn't that what we're talking about here?
Well, okay, let me go one step further. If a piece of property is staying with a senior citizen had the exemption, and at the time he got the exemption, the school district was giving a 100% exemption if you're over 65. So that automatically froze him at zero taxes. New person comes in, over 65, but since then the school district said, hey, we can't afford this, we're going to give a $25,000 exemption. That's all we're going to give. So they come in, they qualify for $25,000. The same situation exists here, let's say on the cooling towers. There was a time when TCEQ gave an exemption on cooling towers. They don't do that anymore. So why should the new guy be eligible for it when TCEQ would not grant the exemption or the determination letter if he comes in today? Why should they just carry
exactly
what was already there?
The rules change, the process changes.
The previous owner was grandfathered. The new guy should not be able to take advantage of that.
And I think I want to emphasize that this is something that the business community needs to consider before they start doing this. And they're not, because they're thinking, oh, all we're doing is changing the name. But it's more than that. You know, again, Chapter 11 was not meant to be efficient, quick, and easy. It was meant to be onerous. It was meant not to be efficient. It was meant to put people's feet in the fire to make sure that that's exactly what they're doing, because public policy says that whenever you're going to transfer a tax burden, you want to make sure all your T's are crossed and all your I's are dotted. That's the bottom line. So it's not, you know, and I can understand, again, business saying, well, gee, that's too slow for us. Well, public policy is that if other people are going to, you know, partake in your tax burden, then you've got to go through this onerous process. It wasn't meant to be easy. It was not meant.
No, it's kind of confusing, though, a little bit, like you said, if it's a true lease versus
a buyback.
There are distinguishable differences in that. So, I mean, if there's any provision in there,
and that's because case law gives us that direction. Case law tells us that if you can establish an equitable interest through, you know, that there's a time definite when you're going to buy it back and the bank is going to give it back to them,
Or there's an option, right, is what you're saying?
Well, it's got to be an option. It's got to be more than an option.
So like at the end of the lease, whatever it is, it's a 10-year lease?
And they have to agree to a price, because that's the fair market value of the property.
Then it would be a different story.
It would be a different, it might be a different story. Again, I'll tell you right now that it might be a different story, but at the present time, under case law, the best of my understanding of it, is that this would only apply, or at least that type of equitable interest applies only to government entities. That's the only time. There's no case law on contracts for deed other than the legislature has said, okay, you can do that under this provision.
Because I mean, you see things in these contracts that says that the lessee is responsible for everything.
Doesn't
reporting, you know, from a contractual basis, they've got all the ownerships with
doesn't
the
matter. When I rent a house to somebody, I tell them, you're responsible for fixing the plumbing and this and that. That's, we agreed to that arm's length, and if that lessee agreed to that, knowing that they would not get the exemption, but knowing that they were responsible for the upkeep and everything, that's what they negotiated. Just because they pay the taxes doesn't mean that they qualify for an exemption. If you carry that to its logical conclusion, can you imagine apartment houses where people are renting something? The apartment complex is going to say, oh, well, they've been here, they were here on January the 1st, and they're paying the taxes, therefore they ought to get a homestead exemption on this little.
Well, I'm not talking renting.
Well,
I'm talking where there's an ownership potential, like you said, if there's at the end of the the lease, you have the right to procure that, right, or to buy.
And what that language would look like, I'm not sure, but other than to say that that we would have to scrutinize that. We would have to. Chapter 11 and the case law requires us to
Yeah, it seems like there's two questions, and one is the procedural question that Bob teed up, and you guys have had a pretty good response to it. I mean, I understand. I think the comment that Roland makes about the way it works for almost the exact same applicant, the law can change. I mean, that's duly noted. That's a significant point. The substance of what in this program is an adequate ownership interest, I think, is something we need to take up separately. I mean, you've made some really good points about some of the practical difficulties. I have never been involved in a dispute about this issue, but I've noticed the briefing on a recent item that's been before the agenda. I know that I actually like to hear from staff, and maybe the committee would too, about what the commission views its legal constraints to be under the statute as it relates to ownership interests in these lease situations. That would be a good place to start, and then we could talk about whether there's things we could honestly do to improve it, or maybe we can't.
Well, I think that's something that should be left to the legislature, and if the legislature wants to allow that under this provision, then they're the ones that really have to do that. And my parting comment on that is basically that you know, don't hang your hat on the fact that the lessee is paying the taxes. Under Chapter 11, that is totally irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. It just doesn't apply.
I agree that on Chapter 11, you have to use a very, you got to have a very conservative view on what should be granted. Because, like Bernardo says, whenever you grant the exemption, the firemen still have to be paid, the cops still have to be paid, the teachers still have to be paid. So what happens is you spread that cost to someone else. And the courts have held that you always, when you look at an exemption, you determine it very conservatively.
By the way, I want to go on record that I have no patience for people who knowingly falsify reports. So, and I mean that. We police within our industries to things like that, too. I did not intend to kick an anthill with that. I was, but it seems I did, and we can.
Good question.
Yeah, we can. I still would like to hear from staff if they have any input on this.
And also, if we could hear from staff, how often this has been an issue? Is this two cases a year, or is this 100? You know, I just don't know what the universe is on this issue.
Tim Reedy, there we go. Tim Reedy, TCEQ Environmental Law Division. With regards to the MHCB use determination application, which came out, we've recently reissued that use determination. It was set aside by the commissioners, remanded back, and we've issued a negative use determination. We've issued that negative use determination on the basis that from staff's point of view, and going back to at least 1997, we didn't see a distinction between the sale leaseback type of transactions versus simple commercial leases of pollution control property. There was a lessor, there was a lessee, there was revenue being given to the lessor in the form of lease payments, and that, in our mind, brought them squarely within 1131A. So I imagine what will happen is that now that that use determination has been issued, MHCB will probably avail themselves of their right for the 20-day appeal, and then it will be put to the commission almost exclusively on that issue. So that's probably when we'll know what the commission feels is a sufficient ownership interest. And as far as how many times this comes up per year, I couldn't tell you.
Not just the lease issue, but change of ownership.
Yeah, just change of ownership in general, including the
lessee. I'd have to defer to staff.
Maybe
six times in 15 years.
Change of ownership?
Yeah, we haven't seen a lot of change of ownership.
But the mergers and acquisitions?
What about all the mergers and acquisitions that have taken place? That's a change in ownership. Wouldn't that be qualifying to this?
No, they're still not doing business as the same entity. They don't have to.
And unless they filed an application, we wouldn't know. Now, we've seen one of the utilities, when they changed names, one of the appraisal districts they were in required or asked that we reissue the use determination in a new name. But it was the same company. It was just a name change within the company. But as far as mergers and acquisitions, when Chevron and Phillips joined, they started filing applications for Chevron and Phillips, but they never came back and refiled the old ones that were Chevron or Phillips. So it's very infrequent that we see them. All right. Thanks, Ron. We can move on unless there's other discussion on this. I don't want this to take too much of our time. We have plenty to talk about. Let's go to 2B, and I intentionally kept this kind of broad partial use determinations. We all know we've been talking about Tier 3 and everything that's around it. So I'll open it up for discussion. I'm sure there will be quite a bit.
Well, I sent all y'all a spreadsheet where you could kind of calculate the three options we had in front of us, and I sat down and did finally had some time yesterday and ran a bunch of bumpy numbers up and down, and of the existing ones, I still like the original one that's in the rule, but I must say that I don't like any of them in totality. And I spent some time, and I hate to confuse issues, but if you wanted something that's simplified, here's a, whoops. And I'm sure nobody's going to have the time to really review this in time to make a decision, but at least this one, if you bump up your original cost for your pollution control equipment, the percentage goes up. If the operating cost goes up, the percentage goes up. If the ratio of production goes down, the percentage goes up. But I'm not sure that we'll ever come to any kind of an equation that everybody's happy with that does everything. And whenever you get this around, there's a small subtraction on the end of this, and that makes everything go to zero if you put in exactly the same plant. Thank you. And like I said, I'd have gotten this to you earlier, but I didn't do it until yesterday.
I think we've discussed this before, but if the flip side occurs, if there's improved technologies, and actually there's not inflation that continues, and the actual new cost is lower than the old cost,
then why should it get an exemption? Because this whole program is to loosen the burden of extra costs you would have to put up to do pollution control. So,
but we're still trying to exempt pollution control property.
Well, we're,
I haven't really thought through this. Let me think.
I'm trying to figure out the nexus between operating cost and the value of property. We're trying to figure out the percentage of a piece of property that's pollution control, and this is doing that using operating cost numbers.
Yes. But it also has adjustment there for capacity. If they're not the same capacities, you're old and new, that it does an adjustment for that as well.
All right. Our current formula uses the value of what's produced. The theory that that's a predominant way in which y'all value property. Right. What's the what's the economic value you produce with that property?
But in,
right.
In, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just trying to sort that through.
Well, I did it this way because that number actually drops out because you're and unless you have a different. If this works if it's the same marketable product. It does not work if you're making a byproduct that is has a different value than the main product. So, again, like I said, none of these equations do everything. But if the product was the same, then that number actually drops out of the equation when you put all this together.
Did you really mean to say operating cost?
Yes.
It seems operating cost old would be a lot harder to determine than operating cost new, depending on how old it is.
Well, I mean, you got the same thing with the existing equation. I don't have, the only thing in here I have that's not in the existing equation is expected life of the equipment.
And I don't have a perfect formula either. It's easier to pick at someone else's formula than to have a perfect formula. But any other thoughts, alternatives?
One thought that was provided to me by was that we might be limiting ourselves by looking for a, as you say, perfect formula. That we might find it productive to find ways of distinguishing between types of property, that a formula works better for this type of property and another formula works better for another type of property. And while I don't have, in my mind, a vision of different formulas for different types of property, that is something, that concept is not one that is repugnant to me at all. Because that, if that's a way that helps us better identify and separate productive property and or productive value and non-productive pollution control value, by having three different formulas for three different types of property,
and having a decision point that's reasonably easy for them to make to apply which formula to, I think that makes sense. And I would credit George with telling, suggesting that to me.
Well, I echo that sentiment. I think that it's clear that there are some equations that have been teed up. I think the thing that Greg teed up may be a real good solution for a lot of projects, but maybe not perfect for everything. Some of the things that, that Wayne has talked about, I think, might work for some things, but we have problems with them. So that goes to the very heart of it. I think if we as a committee can agree to maybe give advice to the commission that the way we see the statute, it's consistency as the program's implemented, but you're not going to ever have that perfect equation that's got to be applied the same way every time. It's a little hard for the agency to figure out how to implement the statute. And, you know, with the words on the page, we've got to help maybe give them some, at least our take about from a multiple source of constituencies here. You know what? Consistency when it comes to Tier 3 is going to have to be, you guys are going to have to evolve some equations and maybe bounce them off us as you develop them that fit different categories.
And the first thing that came to my mind was uniformity. I don't see a uniformity issue with that concept any more than when you value property, you might use an income approach on one and a market approach on another and a cost approach on another. So you're still getting to market value and we're still trying to get the pollution control of property.
I think
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, the important thing I think for me is that the rules establish what this is, and so the action that's taking place once the application comes in is the uniform application of the rules, and that we're not in a situation where we're saying, well, hey, I've got a whole new idea on how to do this. Doesn't that make sense to you, Mr. Commissioner? And then now we're into debate there, and the commission's making a decision on that, whereas someone who didn't have that idea showed up 2 months earlier and got a different determination. Right? I mean, the rules ought to set out and guide, and it ought to be done prospectively, not on a, hey, I've got a new equation, I think this works. Okay, we all agree. I mean, that's, I think it has to be laid out in rule, and there has to be a decision matrix they go through that's uniformly applied, no matter who the applicant is, no matter what ideas the applicant have on how it ought to be done differently.
I still struggle with this, though, and I'm going to the data that I provided. One of the items on the list that was added by the legislature was integrated gasification plants. So I went to Summit Power, which is the only major. There's some other IGCC plants, but that's the only big coal one. And if you look at, for example, and this is only from, this isn't including, they also have a urea production facility, but this is only including the electricity part. If you look at their pounds per MMBTU of, say, nitrogen oxide, it's about 0.01, whereas some of the luminant, which are using, you know, supercritical, that, you know, your choice would be do a regular coal plant with a bunch of scrubbers on the end, or go to this new technology, which is going to be generally cleaner. And so their, you know, their NOx per MMBTU are not a tenth, but say a sixth of what the, say, luminant TXU Oak Grove is. You know, whether these numbers are real or through, you know, this has just been, they've just applied, so we don't know whether these are going to be the final numbers in the permit, but just an example. So if you went by a straight emissions, you could argue, well, we should take, you know, 70% of the value of the plant off the, or of the gasification part of it off the books. Whereas if you went by cost, and these are from, I was on this working group with Aus Energy to look at their clean energy plan, and so these were the numbers provided by the consultant. So again, I don't know if these are true, but you could say, well, a regular supercritical coal pulverizes, your overnight costs are going to be about $1,800 a kilowatt, and for coal IGCC, not even taking into account carbon capture, they're going to be about a third more. So if you used more of a capital cost, you'd say, well, they should get about a third of the gasification unit off. So it makes a big difference whether you're doing emissions-based or cost-based.
And emissions was the 70%, you said, that kind of...
Well, on this one example, and again, it depends if you look at sulfur dioxide or nitrous oxide or, you know, it depends what pollutant you look at. So how do you, I assume for most, right now, you know, NOx is going to be the most important indicator for a coal plant. That's probably what you're going to base it on. But, you know, let's say they had a really good PM... You know, they hardly produce any PM10. You could see an applicant saying, well, I'm going to use PM10 as my emissions calculator. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, so, I think that one of the great things about looking at these calculations again is that we are entering into an era where people are making decisions to trying to decide, do I do add-on controls
mm-hmm.
or do I do production of, you know, related improvements of the utilization of the fuel, which is, you know, IGCC is just not, I mean, there's a couple of abatement devices, but it's basically the way that the nature of the way the fuel's
right. Well, it's like a combined cycle versus single cycle.
Right. And I think that that is kind of the heart and soul of what was going on in 2007 when we started figuring out why, well, what needs to change about the program. The program has not been well suited for this new era we're about to enter into.
So would you say you would give applicants both potentials, a cost and emissions, and then let TCEQ decide?
Yeah, I mean,
which doesn't seem to fit the uniformity.
Well, I think that that's, it kind of goes to, as long as we set out in the rule what the equations are going to be and maybe some criteria about how the agency would choose mm-hmm. among them, I do think it would be bad to hamstring the commission because there are situations where that would be warranted. I mean, for example, the coal plant that it would compete against, you know, its add-on controls will be 100% exempt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you tallied up the, you know, the economics of that plant, you know, you might, I'd like the commission to have the discretion to say, you know what, if we're given 100% exemption on all these add-on controls, but this guy over here is trying something new, and he's not going to get an exemption for a bunch of other stuff, and here's what that capital cost looks like. I mean, I'd like them to be able to look at both.
Mm-hmm. Did other people look at the four examples they gave us on the HRSGs? Because there were, you know, there was frankly, the one I liked the best was the substitution idea, you know, which I think was Tenasca, which was just, we're going to spend $48 million on this HRSG. We could have gone with single cycle and spent $12 million on scrubbers. $12 million is about a quarter the value of $48 million, so... we're going to seek 25% exemption because if we had, I mean, that to me makes sense, whereas the one that said we're going to have to replace our entire electricity production and because we're going to produce 98% less emissions, take it all off, that seemed a little high to me, frankly. So emissions, I mean, I like the concept of emissions, but I can just see it being so... You know, do you base it on MMBTUs? Do you base it on total emission? You know, just I can see a lot of playing with numbers to make it work for, you know, one side or the other. Whereas a substitution cost seems more in line with the intent of the statute.
I'll admit I struggle with realizing there's some items from Part A, and I think it's what you're saying, the ones that are Part A, 100% exempt,
mm-hmm.
and there's maybe, say, 80 or 85% of the remaining items. That's what you would do the comparison on? Is that your formula? Is that where you're going with that?
Well, in the case of the Tenasca HRSG, what they said was we had a choice. You know, we could have done, now, granted, probably they would never have done a single cycle gas turbine because it's probably more expensive to operate, et cetera, not as efficient. But their point was, if we had done that, we would have produced 66% more NOx, and we would have had to put on all these expensive scrubbers. Instead, we're doing a more efficient process with less NOx. So therefore, what we need to exempt is the value of the scrubbers we would have had to put on.
I think what you're saying could make sense if you included the part you referred to about operating cost
mm-hmm.
differences. If you looked at the entire economic
picture of it.
Right, because they're able to sell more electricity than they would have under the other example.
I still have problems with something that makes, has so much of a return on investment that it pays for itself in less than 3 years, getting a tax exemption on top of that. I mean, this program was to help relieve the burden of doing pollution control. It wasn't intended to be a general tax break. It had a purpose, and I think that if you ignore the economics, you're flying in the face of what everybody voted for in the first place.
Yeah, and I don't want to debate that issue as much as I would say, just to Cyrus's comment, I'm not offended at all in a situation where you have an IGCC plant where the emissions benefit is 70%. I mean, it's because that equipment is extraordinarily expensive, okay? I mean, and it's a different way of doing things. I mean, I don't think that's...
But it's probably not 70% more expensive.
Right, but I'm not sure that that is what this program's about. I mean, I think this program's about pollution control. Now, I think we should probably make sure we have checks and balances so we avoid abuses, and that's the devil in the details. But just viscerally, I'm not necessarily offended that an IGCC plant would get 70% because it's a 70% cleaner operation if the numbers play out on the given...
Doesn't that... I mean, if they had the option to build a whole new plant, or they could have built the old plant at a higher emissions, then it doesn't meet the underlying Prop 2 test, which is that the new technology had to be mandated. So this is mandate relief.
Well, either one is going to be mandated.
Or exceed. I mean, yeah. They're exceeding the standard.
Right. The mandate is going to be either, you know, pounds per hour, or however TCEQ and the permit measures it. And there's going to be some averaging and some maximums and minimums, but...
You've got to have a basic requirement to control that pollutant, then, and I agree with that, but the statute allows for people who take that extra step to exceed the emission limit to make additional environmental performance, that those additional costs should be exempt, because that the whole concept of this statute is those that are investing in the greater good, that will be levelized over, you know, multiple taxpayers as opposed to one. They're not benefiting necessarily directly from that. And so not a whole lot of people exceeded a whole bunch, but in situations where the step change of technology like IGCC does jump the emissions, I'm not necessarily opposed to the idea that you would give them.
Now here's where it gets complicated. So say say the Summit Power Plant actually works, and it's a technology change, and then that becomes the best available control technology. So any new coal, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but at some point it may be that all coal plants have to go that route or another. Then does that, you know, then would you use the same test? So,
and that's why I think you give the commission discretion.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could talk about how to do that. But yeah, I mean, over time, that's the truth with regard to every determination they make under Tier 3, right? The comparison is evolving about what the baseline is.
What if I have a coal plant and I decide to tear it down and build a nuclear plant there and I reduce NOx to zero? Do I get 100% tax exemption under Cyrus's theory?
What wasn't my theory, actually. I was just giving the example.
I mean, if we're using pollution as the test for the tax exemption, you've got an inevitable race to the bottom. You will have zero taxation eventually.
Well,
as you compare yesterday's technology to today's technology. This is the problem we fought 10 years ago on this issue. You can't use a whole technology. You can't look at a whole plant and say, well, this plant is pollution control equipment because the NOx emissions are 50% less than what we did 10 years ago. You will be ceasing to pay taxes in the future.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that. Your comparison is current state-of-the-art alternative ways to do the same thing. I think the nuclear, I mean, somebody represents some entities in both of those industries. I mean, I want us to stay away from examples that are absurd. That just won't happen. Okay, ask anybody who's trying to build a nuke plant. But it's about comparing others that generate power with the same type of technology. I think that's why the Herzig situation is tricky, because the comparison there, it's a slippery slope, and I think we need to talk about how to put some restraints on that. I agree. Okay, but when you're talking about a coal plant to a coal plant, I'm comfortable with those comparisons. I would never support a new plant to a coal plant comparison.
Or a combined
and Paul, do we,
to an IGCC, because they're both gas.
Right.
Right.
Paul, on one of the other items on that K list is ultra supercritical, and I wasn't able to really find, you know, numbers on what that would cost and what the emissions benefit would be. Do you have any information from Lumina? I'm sure you looked at those different technologies when you're looking at your new coal plants.
I don't have any in hand. I could probably look for some.
Because that would be another example. If ultra supercritical gets you, you know, a 20% benefit in terms of emissions and it costs, you know, then we could do another comparison. If it costs 10% more, should the exemption be 10% or should it be 20%? You know, that's going to be the issue.
Right.
And so, Mike, are you saying we should, you would want to provide several different approaches that could be used to the commission and then give them discretion to say in this, you know, the emissions doesn't work in this case, or it should be cost substitution, or what is your proposal?
Now, I don't have a proposal. I'd like to hear about how, if folks ran numbers, other examples through Greg's example, for example. I like the idea of a basic equation, but with discretion for the agency to evolve new equations and develop them through guidance and ultimately codify them. And in terms of current events, for the committee to think about checks and balances about how whatever equation we come up with initially could be controlled. I'm not sure we have two or three equations to offer yet. I think the universe should be small. I don't think it needs to be wide open. I think that generally industry probably would prefer to have the ability to use the agency's engineering judgment and come in each time to do that, but I'm also interested in building consensus, so I'm not going to propose that. We're okay with having a set of examples so that the taxing authorities can have a little bit more idea of, you know, what the rules of the game are going to be. I'm comfortable with doing that.
Yeah, John, do you want to comment? He was asking for a while. Thanks.
One quick comment.
Am I on? John Kennedy with the Texas Taxpayers and Research Association. I just wanted to make a comment along the lines of what Don and Cyrus have said. Our organization was the prime mover in getting this legislation, the constitutional amendment, passed in cooperation with Bennett and Don and other folks. But ours was organization that brought this forward and got it passed. This is a property tax exemption. What the statute says is if you use property to reduce pollution in response to a government regulation, we will not tax it. The statute does not say you only get an exemption if you save this amount of money. It has nothing to do with cost. It has nothing to do with operating cost. The statutory test is use. And what you're trying to argue about is a surrogate for determining using an engineering basis to determine how much of the equipment is used for one purpose or another. But I suggest to you, Wayne, the reason that it will continue to be exempt, if I have a piece of pollution control property that has qualified for exemption, new technology comes along that makes a piece of equipment that's more efficient in doing that, and I replace my old equipment with new equipment, it's tier one, it controls pollution, it doesn't make a bit of difference if I spent less money on the new equipment than the equipment I was replacing. It's being used to control pollution, and therefore it's exempt. It has nothing to do with the expenditures you make. That's your job and Roland's job to put it on the tax roll at the value you think is appropriate for market value. And if I'm using it all for pollution, it's exempt. That's what the statute says. You talked about the purpose of the legislation. You are right that was one of the motivations that we had for bringing this forward, because our members were going to have to spend an awful lot of money to get in compliance with clean air. But the courts have said over and over and over again, you're entitled to read the plain language of the statute
And what the statute says is what it means. And the statute says there is only a use test that is relevant. So you've got to find a way, and it's very difficult. I'm no engineer by any stretch of the imagination and haven't got a clue about the science associated with it. But comparable operating costs and so forth, I submit, is a very poor way to get at the question of how much of a piece of property in a mixed-use situation is production as opposed to pollution control. But that's what you're trying to get at. I think, Cyrus, your suggestion about the comparable method comes a lot closer to that in saying that in those situations where there's a mixed use, if I did it another way and produced the same amount of power in another way, and I would have had to spend this to clean it up to get in compliance, that's a reasonable basis to make a use determination. To say that if I put this equipment in and it makes me operate more efficiently or less efficiently, I don't think that has anything to do with how much pollution you're controlling or not controlling with the use of that property.
But if you make a decision to put something in and it's purely an economic decision, and it happens to reduce pollution, but that wasn't your reason for putting it in.
That's what I'm saying, Wayne. It doesn't matter what your reason, if you put it in and you put it in to comply with.
No, you put it in.
Then you won't qualify. And then when you submit your application, the commission will say, you're not doing this to get in compliance with an environmental regulation, and they will kick it out.
Again, it's to meet or exceed.
Yes.
But my point is, and I think you've missed it. I'm going to see if I can articulate it well. Yeah, I've done some stuff for pollution control. But I've primarily done this. I've done something for economic reasons. It happens to reduce pollution, so part of it happens to, but the pollution control is a byproduct. It has nothing to do with.
That doesn't matter. Is it being used to reduce pollution in order to get into compliance with the government regulation? And if the answer to that is yes. It doesn't make any difference why you did it. And the fact that you put it in and it made you operate more quickly, more efficiently, so you recouped your cost in 3 years, that doesn't matter. If it's being used to control pollution, it's not on the tax roll.
John,
that's what the law says.
Let me make sure I understand y'all's position. Let's say I start a company tomorrow, Bennett's Energy Company, and I have a piece of land and I'm going to build a plant. I could build a coal plant or I can build a nuclear plant.
Okay.
I build a nuclear plant. There's no scrubbers or anything on there. How do you address that by your theory? Can I make an application that says that because I emit less NOx?
No, because you're using the plant to produce electricity. You're not using the plant to control pollution.
But don't you see that I've chosen a process that is pollution control by not picking a coal plant?
I don't think that would qualify in submission to the commission.
And Bennett, there's three examples, and we.
I don't believe that would qualify.
I represent an entity like that, and that application will not be forthcoming.
Exactly.
The other two entities that are building new plants are not making those applications.
That's the logical extension of where we're going. By what Cyrus was saying.
And you could say the same thing about wind turbines. Hey, I'm going to put all these wind turbines in to replace a coal plant, so the wind turbines are completely exempt. I know there's a legislation.
Let's do a different analysis, a different one. I have a choice between an old-fashioned coal plant and a new coal plant that, and again, I don't know the technology that injects it in the ground or has no NOx. Do I get a
exemption? The exemption is not for the plant. The exemption is for the equipment that's used in the process. It's not for the whole plant. You don't apply for an exemption
for the plant. And the way this works is it gets a little more sophisticated, but certainly the plant's not exempt. Okay, the analysis that Cyrus is going through is, let's just talk about boilers. If it's different pressure differentials and that additional, instead of, you know, we don't have any more add-on devices to buy to meet the standard, we've got to actually do something more, and so we increase pressure. And so pressure becomes that element, that incremental difference becomes the new pollution control item. We're not saying the entire boiler is exempt. We're saying that the difference between what the old pressure would have achieved and what the new pressure achieves is the pollution control benefit percentage.
And the debate is the difference on the emissions or is the difference on the difference in cost?
Right, and I think the basic of the consistent with what John's saying, I think the statute's about pollution, so I think we should start there. I'm okay with giving the commission some discretion for checks and balances, but I wouldn't base it on the Wayne's argument. I'm trying to be deferential to y'all's concerns about let's make sure we don't have abuses, but I think starting with the premise of the pollution delta, it's big as long as we don't let absurd examples like a nuke plant or a wind plant. Those can't be acceptable. I agree, and I think the commission should be given the rein to say no to those applications. The IGCC example is just like the boiler differential in terms of pressure. Again, it's not the whole plant. It's the way the fuel is prepared, okay? It produces a syngas that's then combusted. That back half isn't going to get exempt. It's the differential. It's the pollution control benefits of that front end. Okay, so it's going to take engineering judgment by the commission, but I think an emission based, a pollution based equation that starts the process is much more in line with that statutory mandate. I mean, I
as long as we can again make sure that the applicant is really identifying that part of the production process that is helping with the pollution control. Because the danger would be, now, I mean, I know for a fact, in this case, Summit Power isn't going to be making an application because they're getting exemptions, local exemptions anyway. So this isn't going to, I'm just using this as an example. But the danger would be you have a $2 billion plant that says, because I'm 70% cleaner, I want the whole 70% of the plant off, when what we want to focus on is the part of the process that actually leads to the cleaner emissions.
Right.
Yeah. It sounds like this discussion will extend much longer than today. And to try to pull us in a little bit, could be, and I'm thinking of a timeline, because we have a few days or whatever to maybe have a, I think the commission plans to meet on the 30th. It's going to... So if we can be thinking about what can we do to either tweak this. Okay. All right.
I'm just passing around an example. Mike, you said you wanted to see some more examples.
Yeah,
Cyrus, I took your numbers that you emailed and ran them through Greg's equation. Just figured I'd pass that out so you guys could have a look at it.
So now we're comparing some gas plants here. Is that what we're doing, Robert?
Yeah, that's correct. I took the pounds per megawatt hour and just took the capacity of the plant and assumed an operating hours per year, calculated total emissions, and then figured the compared, you know, the two different examples, and then got your percentages that way.
And you used the NOx, it's based on the NOx values?
It's based on all the emissions.
Oh, all the emissions.
Yeah, just totaled them all together.
Just a straight average. Which is an interesting question you raised, Cyrus, and that seems like maybe a more appropriate thing is that, you know, it's all pollution, there's multiple standards.
Right, the one that might be, you might not look at a CO2 until it's actually regulated, right? Because it's not yet regulated. But in terms of the criteria, air pollutants, all of those are regulated under Clean Air Act, so.
Is there an accepted standard on how you would weight these various pollutants?
I don't think there is. I mean,
I mean, you could make the argument that actually the ones that are going to be important in a near non-attainment area like Austin would be NOx and VOCs, and the other ones aren't going to really matter that much.
Right.
Like carbon monoxide, it's, you know, it's not a real, I mean, it's a concern for those living around it, but it's not as much of a concern.
Right.
So maybe an applicant would be saying, because I need to meet emission standards for either non-attainment or near non-attainment areas, I'm choosing to do a combined cycle versus just a turbine. The thing that's probably not in this calculation is the guy who runs the plants was on vacation, so he can give me the actual operating hours. So all I had was the pounds per megawatt hour and the megawatt capacity. And I'm pretty sure, well, I know for a fact, they're running Sand Hill 5 as a baseload plant, and they're running the other Sand Hills as a more of a peaking plant. So it's going to be a very different. It's going to be very different in terms of the operating hours.
Any idea on what those might be? I mean, I could plug the numbers in. I have the.
Yeah. I may have that somewhere. So you didn't use, in terms of the cost, so the operating cost doesn't matter. It's just the sort of the emission, the amount it's operating and the emissions, but the actual cost of running the plant in this scheme wouldn't matter.
Right, that's not factored in at all.
Let me see if I have that actual.
Robert, do you have the ability quickly to just, if you were to go to Roland's question, if you walked away from a straight average and you just looked at, just call it NOx, to Cyrus's point?
Yeah, I can.
You might, just to show how much that might throw the number. It'd be good to know how both of those numbers work. Because there's probably some examples, Roland, where the commission can tell that a decision on an equipment change was made for one pollutant. If it's in, like Cyrus says, it may not.
Well, it looks like this is about, this is about 66, yeah, it's about 66% cleaner, the Sand Hill 5 versus the other Sand Hills. But I guess the other question would be, here you're comparing some gas turbines, units that are much older, with a much newer combined cycle plant. So is that the fair comparison, or would the comparison be, if you were to build it today, to meet today's standard, because maybe some of those emissions, you have to meet stronger emission standards today than you would if you built it.
Well, your gas turbines would be more efficient to start with.
Yeah, so it may be you wouldn't compare a 1985 plant with you'd be comparing a 2009 plant with a 2009 plant.
So you'd have an even lower number.
Yeah, you'd probably have a lower number, but I don't know that.
This was just the data that.
This is just the data I had.
Oh, okay.
Well, if I take, for instance, the first calculation, if I take and just look at NOx instead of the sum of emissions, it ends up being 70.1%. The second one ends up being 59%.
Mm-hmm. I've got from the comparative costs of California Central Station Electricity Generation Technologies staff report from 2007, so a few years old. They have some emission factors where they say, for NOx, conventional combined cycle, 0.056, and for simple cycle, about 0.093. So that's more like a 30% difference. So that's comparing apples to apples, mm-hmm. which is about what you'd expect.
Would be a great way to tune up the equation, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you could refer to either EIA or, California does a lot. You could refer to some publications out there that have emissions factors for new plants. I don't actually have numbers. I have dispatch of resource unit specific for August of, I think, 2008, and it's basically showing that, as to the new plant and the coal plant are your base loads, and then added wind, and then the combined Sand Hill combined cycle is your next. Then comes Decker steam and the Sand Hill gas units. So the gas units are actually only run from around noon to 7 p.m., your peak period. So it's going to be a much smaller amount of operating hours. So I don't know how that would impact, whether you'd consider that. Are you measuring just while they're running the comparison, or are you measuring in a year?
Well, the only reason I used operating hours was to just convert your pounds per megawatt hour into a total emissions.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and my suggestion is we would want to do it on a pound per million BTU basis, because that's the way the agency permits facilities. I think emission rates, this is a technology evaluation, and if you're doing an apples-to-apples technology evaluation, it really should be on emission rate.
It would actually be easier.
Does emission rate mean pound per megawatt hour? Or
pound per million BTU. The emission rate that that the agency uses.
It would be an easier number to come up with in doing an application if you use the MMBTU of the fuel. I mean, just, that's an easier number to get a hold of, and, you know, you might have a different, slightly different emission of one type or another because of the heat or the temperature which you burn in it, but to simplify things, if you use the MMBTU of the fuel you would be burning would be easier for the commission to handle.
A heat input based emission rate.
Yeah.
And I think that there may be default values, for instance, for coal or gas, the amount of NOx from burning MMBT, I'm not sure that's exactly what you said, but not only are there values for the heat content of the fuel, but I think they're default values for actually the emissions, uncontrolled emissions from fuel also.
So it would be pounds of NOx per MMBTU, basically?
Yeah. And the agency uses those numbers all the time, and it's permitting.
Yeah, it would just simplify their life using the fuel value rather than trying to figure out how much of which emissions.
Right, I think Robin was just trying to make an apples-to-apples for Cyrus's comparison, but I think we might all agree that the agency would want to implement this a little bit more efficiently in line with the way they do it.
What's the application for on this example, Cyrus? Is it for the turbines themselves, or is it for...
Oh, there was no application. This lost energy.
What would be the...
It would be, say, they were about to build, because they are, in their energy plan, for example, they're going to build another combined cycle plant, I think, to replace some of the older Sand Hill units or replace part of Decker. So the example would be, I guess in this case, a municipality, you know, it probably wouldn't matter. But say they were a private utility.
What piece of equipment would the application be for?
It would be for the HRSG, probably for the HRSG, saying we're using a more efficient process to meet emission standards. We could have gone this other route, but we're going to be more efficient. And I'm not advocating the emissions approach. I'm just trying to say we did the emissions approach, what kind of numbers we get. And I think the answer is, probably somewhere around 30% is probably the answer.
Of the HRSG, not of the plant.
Yeah, of the HRSG.
You know, this reminds me that this HRSG thing has got another problem to it, in that are you just talking about the HRSG itself, or everything that kind of, all the steam system and the turbine afterwards? And because some of the applications included everything that people filed. And it becomes a lot less of a problem in my mind if you're considering just the HRSG. But how do you identify stuff that is entirely production, you know, as opposed to what part of it is you're starting with in the first place? It's pollution control. You know, I'm not sure how you can justify saying a steam turbine has got any pollution control property to it at all.
Well, just in fairness, the agency has always denied those, as far as I know, isn't that correct? The agency has always denied the turbine, and they've only considered partial applications on the HRSG.
I just wanted to bring that up, make sure everybody was aware that people had filed for the entire thing.
Okay, I want to go back to my earlier comment. How can we, in the amount of time that we have here, what can we do to possibly tweak or influence the rules that will be published pretty soon? And it could be we need to come back to this after we hear from staff about what their concepts are. That's going to be published in this month. What are your thoughts on how we proceed on this? Because we have a lot of discussion ongoing for hours and hours.
Right. No, I think this equation, the mission-based approach, with the kinds of protections that we've talked about, making sure they apply to the actual differential equipment, not the whole plant. I mean, there's checks and balances, what I referred to earlier. I think that's the kind of thing we might be suggesting the commission consider in their current rulemaking, is that we've got a lot of controversy and unintended consequences associated with the current cap, and I want to seriously consider as a committee whether we would make a recommendation to explore a emission-based cap, or whatever we call it, with certain checks and balances to make sure that that number, that percentage, is applied to the equipment, that which is different from one plant to another, and to prevent what Bennett was referring to, is that, you know, you first have to come into the equation, you know, and there's a reality check about what's the purpose of the plant, and then you talk about what's the difference between that plant and a plant that's in the same, you know, mm-hmm. class of technology, nuke plant to nuke plant, for example.
Okay, I guess what I'm getting to, do we have a proposal that has enough parameters around it that we could seriously consider and start drafting or proposing a motion? Or
I'm not hearing it. I mean, Michael lays out something that then has, it identifies all the areas where we need some checks and controls and to address issues, and they're really significant issues. And I don't hear us having those issues addressed, of having us in a way that recommends a rule that can just be mechanistically applied that takes care of these issues. And we have an existing rule that, I mean, all these formulas have problems. Existing formula has some problems. But I'm not sure we've come up with anything that doesn't have more problems than what we have. And from a nexus standpoint, I'm just struggling with the logical nexus between a emissions reduction and the value of property, or in the property and use of property. I don't think this passes John's test. And I think from what John's testimony he just gave, it doesn't sound like this fits that. So, I'm not trying to say never, but I'm just struggling with this. I'm struggling with the nexus of emissions reductions to the amount of capital committed to pollution control and not production.
I thought John had basically said, you know, it's equipment used to control pollution. It's the use test. And, you know, the emissions is that test. I mean, if that equipment reduces pollution, and I think he even said that the plant wasn't part
right,
of
but
that.
We're struggling, with property that has a dual use, right? And we have to figure out a way to separate out the productive use from the pollution control use. And so my question on all this to myself is always, okay, what's the nexus here between how we're doing this and, you know, how does it logically work? And I don't see the connection between emissions reduction and the amount of property or value of property being committed to pollution control versus that being committed to production.
Well, first of all, you got to have a particular piece of property in mind. I mean, because every situation is going to be unique to itself. I think everybody's addressing different issues and thinking about different things. But I think, first of all, it would be, you know, the charge of the TCEQ and the applicant to identify those pieces of equipment which meet the test of reducing pollution, right?
And if there's any Tier 1 equipment that can be identified, or what would we think of as Tier 1, any equipment that is, I mean, that's the perfect solution from
Tier 2
standpoint. But the problem we have and we've struggled with is finding is how do we handle this property that, hey, instead of putting on pollution control equipment, I can do this. Instead of putting a scrubber on or a filter on a smokestack, I can replace that emitting burner with an electric burner. That's the classic example we struggled with in
you know, 10 years ago, and John was on that advisory committee with us, where we came up with the existing formula with all of its problems. And I'm just saying that I don't hear us having gotten to a place where we've identified something that has worked, that we know works better than the existing formula. I don't.
At a minimum, it seems the existing formula has a problem with the old cost in that it assumes that it replaces something that had no environmental benefits or no pollution control.
Well, it doesn't even identify the pollution control equipment either. It just identifies an economic benefit, and therefore you equate that to pollution control versus production. And that, as we've seen, has lots of issues in itself, because depending on the year, depending on what you're measuring, depending on the cap rate, depending on the line, after tax, before tax, you get a whole different answer. So I think we all know that. So I was just trying to, as Mike said, try to get something that's basically, from a technical standpoint, this is a constant, and now you measure from that constant every time. Now, identify the equipment associated with that constant. It depends on the process or the parameters or what's out there. Is it control? Is it prevention? Et cetera.
Well, if we can come up with all the rules and standards that address the issues that Michael mentioned, then, you know, I don't have a problem with doing it, but those are real important.
And I understand what Bennett was trying to say, too, that we're basically trying to, whatever we change, we want to limit the unintended consequences. We don't want a huge exemption that was not intended, or make it worse than what it is now, which I think is what you're saying, Don. So, but I think we can improve it. And I don't know if emissions is the only answer.
I mean, I wonder if we could give some advice, have emissions with a number of caveats about, you know, it's operating hours and based upon permit limits, because I can see an applicant saying, well, I over, you know, I did so well that I'm going to overperform my permit limits, but there's no way to test that, and you put the counties in a real precarious situation. But then also have a substitution of property as another way you could do it, like in the example of Tenasca, where they said, well, we would have spent $12 million on a scrubber if we'd gone this other route. So that's, you know, that's about the value that we think we should get an exemption for. Now, they tried to exempt both the steam turbine and the Herzig, but, you know, irregardless, they're using a substitution method and saying, you know, it would have cost us $12 million if we'd gone this other route. So it could be we try to give some, I don't know if that meets the uniformity test of what the legislature passed, if we're saying, well, there's a couple options you can look at.
And the cost is, it occurs to me that the cost is a lot harder to control abuse on, because there may be situations where you're spending more for other reasons, and I'm not going to go down the road of speculating about what applicants' intentions are, because I tend to believe that John's right about that. I just think if the agency is going to be have to come up with a factor to make calls on things, I'd rather them do what they do for a living, which is assess emission impacts, not cost impacts, not operating cost benefits, not other things. So to answer your question, I don't have a specific proposal. I think that I'd like to keep live the issue, and maybe we'll be able to, between now and whenever we meet again, continue to ball forward and come up with some red line strikeout and some language that would do what Don's referring to.
How about, and I realize this is the risk of eliminating the continuity on this discussion, but how about we hear from staff on item 2C, and then we talk about that, and they'll give us, over lunch, a lot to think about 2B and 2C. Does that sound logical, or at this point? Because since we weren't real close to getting a revised formula. All right.
Okay. So do you want me to just go ahead and talk generally about the staff
Share as much as you're allowed to share.
Okay, good enough. And as you guys are aware, and I sent out an email last week basically telling you that we had moved the agenda date from the 16th to the 30th, and sincerely that was to provide you all more time for discussion and for staff to make changes. Some of the stuff I'm going to get into is going to say, well, there's not a lot of time even now for us to be making changes, but I'll get into that in just a second. We apologize for not releasing the rules on June 4th, but given our procedures for rulemaking, now that date's June 11th, and for the backup, and it was felt like that's the time that is within the commission's process, and that's the time to release the rules. So we have until June 11th, which is next Friday, and the rules will be public next Friday. So in reality, for us to make that happen, we're going to have recommendations from you all post-haste. Almost today. We're going to be working over the weekend to incorporate whatever recommendations that the committee has. Our I guess modus operandi right now is to address any recommendation that the committee has in the rule package, and that means taking your recommendations and at a minimum putting them into the preamble for the ones that we feel comfortable with, and we have time to actually address those in the rules themselves, but at least to open the rules up so that during the public comment period that we potentially can address the recommendations that you have.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Can you tell us if your rules are going to include changes to the cap? Your rule proposal?
That certainly would be staff's recommendation at this time. I don't see how.
Well, that issue will be on the table.
Issue will be on the table. Now, I need to. I mean, I was talking with Tim. I really need to stress the fact that the legal issues associated with just a general recommendation that the committee has, and then we come back at a later date and propose something that's very specific. There may be some issues with that from a legal perspective. And if you want to get into that, I'll let Tim talk about it. But
yeah, maybe you could address that, just since I'm not a lawyer. What would the legal issues be? If we made a general recommendation that we kind of like these approaches, but we didn't give you real specificity, what?
That would be the concern, exactly, that, you know, we leave here today with a general recommendation. We would, the committee recommends that the cap be changed to, let's just say, for an example, an emissions-based cap would be a good idea. And that's the recommendation that goes forward and then is in the rule proposal and it's included in the preamble language. And then later this committee says, okay, well, now we've had our time, we've looked at it, here are the specific equations that we all agree on that we think gets this done. And then that's presented at adoption. And then someone cries foul, well, wait, this didn't get the full vetting because we didn't have a specific equation to look at, and so this runs afoul of notice and comment rulemaking.
Very good considerations. That's what administrative lawyers do, is keep agencies out of trouble. It's a good idea. A solution to that is you obviously have to give, there's principles like fair notice, logical extension, lawyer words, but basically the public's got to be put on adequate notice about what might finally come out. There's a lot of disagreement about what's enough. I would suggest that one solution to that, you've teed up the concept that if the preamble said the commission is considering an emission-based cap, we invite comment on emission-based cap. There's some concern I hear in your voice that might not be enough, because if the final rule is a specific thing, people may complain. I didn't know how that would work. I understand that. One way to solve that problem is to actually put in a, when we fleshed one out, and have the commission say right off the top, say this one proposal the commission is considering and invites comment on is the following equation. We are also inviting comment on, I don't know if they'd use checks and balances, but provisions that would ensure that this equation was not abused and that would maintain consistency with the statutory authorization, and then open it up for comment.
It's yeah, or even be even more specific and say, you know, should the operating cost of the facility be a factor, or should the number of operating hours be a factor in terms of the emission? You know, just whatever we...
I think we could develop such a recommendation.
Yeah, we could develop it. Now, that may not help them making an actual decision, since we'll be putting lots of wiggle room in there, but
right.
Unless we can really come to a consensus, which we may not be able to do.
It could be that during the comment period, the committee does come to a consensus on something much more specific, and it would be one of many comments the commissioners would consider. Mm-hmm. It could be that there are a lot of smart people out there that do a better job than we do that come in and provide ideas about how you could improve the equation. I think at this point, staff's got a dilemma. It's got a rule. It's got to get it done. What language are we going to give them today, okay, to put in the preamble before that rule is released to the public? That's really what this is. This specific question is. And
is there a difference for you in? And I understand this concept of, well, if we come back with a specific formula, then we didn't get fair notice on that. But if you receive comments suggesting changes, you're allowed to consider those comments. Am I right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, I've been fairly successful in my career at having some, frankly, new concepts put into rules during the comment process by our association submitting comments, and they say, oh, okay, that fits into what we're doing, and we put that in. So doesn't that leave this advisory committee the option, if you all tee up CAP as an issue, that whereas if we all just gave you direct advice, you might not be able to put it in, but if we comment, officially comment, and recommend a formula, you'd be able to put it in.
We'd be more comfortable with that.
So we have the option. We don't have to come up with a formula today. If we settle on a formula during the comment period, we can, as a committee, file that comment, and y'all would be in a position to...
Right. My concern was just with a very general recommendation going forward today being included in the rules, and then I suppose something
and then
later.
And then y'all sticking something in later.
Well, and then something coming in during the comment period, and then someone crying a foul saying that wasn't what was included in the rule proposal was not fair notice and a logical outgrowth of the language that was included in the original proposal.
So I'm hearing you say basically you need a formula from us today.
If you, well,
that would be preferable.
In a perfect world, yes, sir.
Okay.
I mean, but we could have a formula that could be tweaked later right. to the public.
Right.
To the extent that we have something that's not too hard for us to get to by the end of the day, with huge qualifications on it. I mean, the agency, any good lawyer that works for an agency is going to say, hey, I want as much specificity as I can in the rules so people can crunch the numbers. And the more technical an issue gets, the more risk you have that people say, I didn't anticipate. It wasn't a logical outgrowth. You guys never gave me the details that I could crunch my own numbers with. If we can give them an example with a lot of qualifications that that's not necessarily where the agency is going to end up, okay, but fair notice, we'd like your input on this thing. If we could as a committee agree that that's a do-no-harm approach here that gets the commission a lot further down the road of getting that kind of security blanket, I think we ought to try to do that.
Puts it out there as an official opportunity to discuss it openly in the public right. forum.
And as Cyrus said, flag some of the issues. I mean, we've got a few on the table right now. We can flag them in a preamble.
And just to kind of restate what you said, it really is an issue of risk of somebody challenging us. Yeah. I mean, it's a risk issue.
Right. And just, you know, I hate to use the phrase, it's good government. I mean, you want to give us, if it's not too hard, we try to give the public as much as we can to chew on during a comment period.
Would you like me to go through?
Michael, I just want to say,
I appreciate what you're trying to do. You identified kind of two parts to this when you talked about this earlier. Changing the cap formula to go to this emissions-based stuff, and then a bunch of other things to address the unintended consequences. And I guess in this case, one of those is kind of something that y'all think improves the cap process. And the other half of it is something that we think is necessary to prevent that cap process from being abused and from taking this program in a direction that we don't want it to go and that no one wants it to go. I'm nervous about putting half of that equation, those two things, saying, okay, we're going to put half that in because we have to have something now and we don't have the other half.
Well, I actually think we could, with some time during lunch, maybe come up with some language to say we are inviting comment to develop regulatory language to ensure that the use of this equation will not result in the following abuses. And we can list them. Because, you know, the solution to that problem is not going to be necessarily a new equation. It's going to be some regulatory language to put some parameters around the process. I think that is better than nothing, and I understand y'all's risk. You don't want to create too much of a presumption that that's going to be the solution. Okay. Let's make it real clear that it's not.
And then what happens when someone cries foul? That wait a second, you're saying we can't suggest the formula change later on. That we have to suggest that now in order to meet this notice standard. But on the other half, we can have that suggested later. Well, if the formula change is subject to being cried foul on, I can't see how the other part isn't subject to being cried foul on.
Everything's subject to being cried foul on. It's just how much of the risk can we whittle off is what this is all about. And I think saying, hey, we've been doing the cap the same way, and we've made a slight tweak, and oh, by the way, we're thinking about it a fundamentally different way, it's not as good as, hey, we've been using the cap, and here's one way we're thinking about tweaking it, but here's another concept that we're exploring, and we invite comment. I mean, no matter what rulemaking you're talking about, you are better off. In a perfect world, we had enough time, where we would get more regulatory language on that second half. I think we can do a lot to accomplish satisfy your concerns by flagging the issues and inviting comment on them. I don't think the agency would be well served to keep waiting for us to get that kind of detail, and so we're just trying to make the best thing we can. And you know, I'm open to language that makes it clear that the agency is not going to presume that this is the right approach.
Yeah. Well, I'm comfortable with the idea of trying to throw the entire issue out for comment without suggesting particular solutions. I think if we're going to have a solution, it needs to be a solution that we all, that is a total solution, or not put out any solution, but I'll put half a solution out.
I get the impression that's not a viable option. Is that what I'm hearing? That would be too general to say we'd like to discuss revision of the cap?
Yeah. Again, the cap, as Miner said, it's on the table. Everyone knows that there's a change that's being proposed to the cost analysis procedure. And so during the comment period, yes, we could receive and review and evaluate a number of different cap allocations that come in during the comment period. My concern was including a recommendation that was as general as the advisory committee recommends the adoption of an emissions-based cap, and then leaving it at that. That, and then later on, an emissions-based cap comes forward, and someone would cry a foul that, well, wait, that emissions-based cap, that original language, this cap that you've come up with, that didn't give me fair notice, and this isn't the equation you've come up with is not a logical outgrowth of the rules as proposed. Therefore, you need to go back to proposal for this rule language.
I see your concern on that. But if that is a concern for the formula, it's a concern for the regulatory controls as well. And so if that is a concern worth saying, we have to rush the formula into the rule proposal now, well, then we need to have the regulatory controls in the rule proposal now as well. I mean, I can't see saying that it's okay to take the risk with one half of this, but not with the other half. we either say that we're going to tee the whole issue up the best we can without specifying something and take the risk he outlines on the whole thing, or not take it on just half of it.
What about using his initial comments and then adding the public cap?
Does staff have a recommendation?
I think that's what he's saying, but he can't say it now.
Let me
well,
say what it is.
I'm sorry. I can get a little bit more detail, but what I wanted to make clear is in terms of recommendations from the committee and the staff's under a lot of pressure to get a staff draft of the rule out really by this next Monday, so they can again go through management review. But you know, I think I would be remiss in saying that the committee cannot appear before the commission at the June 30th agenda. I don't know what they'll think about that, but there's nothing that says you can't appear before that agenda and make recommendations. It's just that they won't be in the staff's draft of the rule.
So we could provide a separate recommendation, is what you're saying? Okay. All right.
Could you, is there a middle, in terms of this, you know, looking at this emissions idea, are you able to say in the preamble, you know, that you're looking at the issue and you invite comments on that approach, and one possible approach is this, without necessarily tying it to a advice from this group, because I don't think we're going to have consensus on that until we work through it.
I mean, certainly.
Would that meet the concern that Tim raised if you were very specific and said one approach that we're considering?
Well, I think
it may not be in there, or I don't know.
I mean, we could do that.
It's certainly done. I mean, both state and federal agencies make reference to constituencies that have proposed things. You know, I can envision language in the preamble that maybe, if the commissioners think it's a good idea, that says one solution that's been proposed by a majority of the advisory committee is X. However, concerns have been expressed by a minority of the committee or by the committee as a whole that they believe shouldn't have regulatory controls, and some of the issues that we're inviting comment toward that end are: Should capital costs be considered? Should operating hours be factored in? You know, I think we could do that today.
I've got a real hang up with the concept that $100 million piece of equipment that has dual purpose, both increases production and controls pollution. That $100 million piece of equipment is 5% tax exempt if it reduces emissions 5%, is 95% tax exempt if it reduces emissions 95%.
Without discounting the production efficiency.
I mean, you're speaking to a particular example, or are you just...
Isn't that how the formula works? Isn't that how the proposed emissions reduction formula works?
It depends on the criteria that you put forth. If you tie it to a piece of equipment, not a plant, then it wouldn't give you that answer.
Right. $100 million plant, $100 million piece of equipment. New equipment goes in. It increases productive capacity, but in a more efficient way.
When you say increases productive capacity, what do you mean?
You get more units.
Okay, so you would discount automatically the units, right? So let's say you increased it by 50%.
I don't know that.
But I'm just saying, I mean, that the formula, you'd have to put language around that when you do that formula. I mean, you can't just, it's like saying the coal plant is to the nuke plant.
Is there a formula on the table that does that, what you're saying?
In every situation, it may not be the same. That's the problem.
Mr. Chairman, we don't know what we're talking about recommending here. We have no...
We have a formula. I would suggest, can we, I really would like for us to have a lot to think about over lunch, and if we'll come back to this, if we can go through the rules, that's as much, again, as much as you can, if you'll get on the talk about our advice. We provided two pieces of advice, and to the extent that that will be in the rules, can you share with us that and any other advice?
Let me start off just to talk about what staff's considering right now. And we are considering a revision of the cost analysis procedure, and certainly primarily because of House Bills 3206 and 3544, it requires the applications of standards and methods adopted under our rules to reviews of all applications, including those Tier 4 applications. So there's something that we definitely need to revise with the cap, because our current cap doesn't work when we're talking about co-products and things like energy production. Those aren't byproducts, and our cap doesn't talk about it. I mean, we've talked about several alternatives that the staff has been considering, and so, you know, I think you can expect to see one of those alternatives as our current recommendation in the draft rules right now, if that makes sense. I mean, that's just where we are.
What about the other things we've made advice about?
And everything that you all provided advice on, recommendations on, will be in the draft rule package, consistent with your advice. In most cases, if it has not been added, and I can get into a little bit more detail, but if it's not been added specifically to the rules, then your exact recommendation will be in the preamble and open to public comment, so that we can get comment on it and make those changes as appropriate for the final publication.
Including the Part A revisions that we didn't formally send you advice on?
Yes. Yes, yes, all of those.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm hearing is that we've done a lot of work, productive work, that's going to end up in these rules. And if we adjourn right now, I'm not suggesting we do, that staff is going to give us a cap suggestion. And my inclination would be to, and it's probably not what the staff wants to hear, but to see what they recommend at this point and then do a lot of hard committee work in terms of whether we can support that or not as a committee, versus trying to come up with an equation today, which may be in total conflict with where they're headed right now as staff. I got to say, I'm with Don. I don't think I can vote today on a revision to the cap because we're just knee deep in this, in all the potential formulas. And I'm intrigued by this pollution standard, but I don't know enough about it to know that I can recommend it as a way to replace good old-fashioned cost analysis. So that's my take on it at this point.
Do we have to throw the old-fashioned cost analysis out entirely? Can't we use a hybrid of, if you've got a cost benefit, if you've got a sulfur recovery unit when sulfur was selling, you know, that type of deal, that you could use that, but then if you had something else that you could flow through the chart. I'm trying to get my friend over here to my right to talk, and he's a little reluctant, but I think we need to get this thing off dead center. Come on, Leo.
Well, I'm just wondering if you really don't have a decision flow chart on which calculation you use, you know, if the existing one's broken for some scenarios, then go to another flow chart diamond and make another decision. If it's, you know, if it's based, needs to be based on emissions and there's not all of this production benefit, then perhaps you use a different equation, you know, a version of Robert's equation. I mean, it seems to me one equation isn't going to fit everything, that there may be three different equations, and you go through a flow chart and say, turn right, turn left, and use this equation. Just a thought. I mean, I'm not convinced there's one equation that's appropriate. Now, you may have one equation that might work 70% of the time. You know, maybe that's the equation we're trying to get agreement on. But I think we need to have the flexibility to use a second or third choice based on some criteria.
Okay. Any other, and again, we're going to discuss this a lot more after lunch. Any other rules?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how much we've talked about this, but what we're also considering is, in terms of implementing the consistency standards under 3206, basically what we read those rules to say is that Tier 4 applications are going to be handled, and Tier 4 is a term of art in our rules, quite frankly, that are going to be handled the same as Tier 3 or whatever type of application they are. So there's a concept of eliminating Tier 4. And we can't get rid of the list because we have to put the list in our rules. So the Part B list that's in 1131.K would still be in our rules, but we get rid of the concept of Tier 4 applications. Those applications would still get the accelerated processing that's required under the statute.
So Tier 3 would look like the items that have the list. You'd have 100% by those that we advise is 100. You'd have V on the others, and then a V on a catch-all for all other partial determinations. Is that kind of what where you're going with it?
No, I hadn't gone that far with it yet.
Okay.
With regard to your recommendations for, and I'm not sure how to talk about this completely, but with your recommendations for the Tier 4 list, I think there are things in your recommendations that we're absolutely comfortable with the Tier 4 list. There are things that we would like to lay out for public comment and have additional time to think about. Primarily there, we're just continuing to think about, not that we have an issue with your recommendations, but continuing to think about whether some of the items that were at 100% are in fact 100% in all situations. And so that's an example of what we might request public comment on. And again, not that we have issues with the committee's recommendation, we just don't know if it would apply in all the situations that would apply.
Can you tell us how long the public comment period will be after the 11th?
60 days after the June 30th agenda.
Okay, so the 60 days won't run from June 11th, they'll run from 30 days. after the 30th, not after the 11th. We're just getting a sneak peek is what the 11th means. The actual formal. Correct.
It's actually not even the 30th.
That's correct.
It's whenever it hits the register plus 30, then it.
That's right. So it might be a few days after.
Yeah, it will be.
It's weekly, right? The register is weekly. So it could
so
be.
It's usually seven, anywhere between 4 to 7 days.
So like I said, we envision putting any of the committee's recommendations into the rule, at a minimum into the preamble, and asking for a public comment on issues like the example I mentioned. We have decision flowcharts in the rules right now, and we've had some discussion about decision flowcharts. There's a concept that we might take those flowcharts and put them in guidance rather than the regulations.
Can you help me out? Where would they be? Would they be published? They wouldn't be a rule, but when you say they're in guidance.
What the concept is to take those actual flowcharts out of the rule.
Would they
just put them in guidance?
Would we see that guidance on the 11th? Will it be part of the something we can see and comment on?
Oh, What, the actual flow charts?
If you move stuff out of the rules into just guidance, would the stuff that you move out and change, will that be published, or will it be something?
That would not be published with the rule package, but I can commit to you that if we move those to guidance.
We can look at them.
We'll sit down and talk about what's appropriate with you to be put in that guidance.
Okay.
And the intent is to allow you more flexibility?
Well, I mean, I guess when actually management was looking at the rules, they looked at those flow charts and they said, we've never seen something like this in a rule before. This is process. This isn't really a rule requirement. And so that's where that concept came from. Process, rules have requirements. Process maybe is better in guidance.
Is the flow chart you have now, is it in your current rules or is it guidance?
Yes, it's in the current rules.
And they're not comfortable? Some.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the discussion. We have some changes to applicants are currently required to send a specific law, rule, or regulation that requires the pollution control property. In many cases, erroneous citations of very large chapters that are in state or federal regulations or laws are provided, and that requires a lot of staff time to determine whether an applicable requirement is actually present or not. That could be reduced if applicants were required to cite specific sections of rules that require the property rather than just this is an air-related. And I'm not being facetious. This is covered under the 401 Clean Air Act or whatever. Because it can take longer for 3 days for an application to receive staff, to get the staff to be able to process, in fact, it actually goes to our financial people first, and they take the check out, and they deal with the check, and then they send the application to staff. Sometimes that's longer than the time the staff has to do an initial administrative review. So we're trying to address that issue in the rules. We're dealing with returning an application should not always be required when a response to a notice of deficiency is inadequate. But when an application is returned, the applicant should be informed of the remaining problems. So we're concept of dealing with that issue. We talked about the ECL list and the committee's recommendations on the ECL list. We talked about the cap. And you all talked about it, when there is an opportunity to specifically address equipment that is pollution control, not including a whole gamut of equipment, but breaking that out into specific activities, and specifically specify that an application can be filed only for individual items or integrated units of pollution control property. So, I mean, that concept, I believe, has been in our guidance and our rules, but it's just something that we want to try to clarify. Another processing change that we're considering, that is, if the applicant desires to apply for use determination for a specific tax year, the rules say the application must be postmarked no later than January 31st of the following year. Applications postmarked after this date will not be processed until after review of all applications postmarked by the due date are completed and without regard for any appraisal district deadlines. And basically what that says is that no application postmarked after January 31st can be touched until all applications postmarked before January 31st have been completed, and that's just not how we do things, and that really doesn't make any sense. As we're working on applications that came in before January 31st, we can get administrative reviews out, technical reviews, we need to be working on the other applications that are in-house. So there's consideration of addressing and clarifying that in our rules. many applications don't provide sufficient information to determine what specific properties covered, whether it's certain properties used wholly or partly for pollution control, whether it's an integrated pollution control system. So we're going to, this problem could be avoided if detailed descriptions of the pollutant source or that they're labeled flow process diagrams, et cetera, just as examples. So we're going to try to tweak the rules a little bit, or that's the consideration, tweaking the rules a little bit so that we address what application information actually comes in.
As you go through this thought process, I'm wondering, and I realize I have a taxpayer's perspective, but do you think about trying to minimize the burden on the applicants while yet getting reasonable accountability? Yes.
And I think that's what hopefully our concept is.
Okay.
And we would certainly, appreciate comments if that does not come through there. I mean, for instance, we could require, for instance, process flow diagrams for everything under the sun. That's not possibly necessary in every situation, at least in my mind. So there would be allowances for when that type of information needs to be submitted and when it doesn't need to be submitted.
What are y'all doing on where the application doesn't describe the property? Y'all have one under review now where they have listed a bunch of land accounts and they're modifying some tankage, and the tankage is not, the account number is nowhere on the application for the tanks.
Okay.
What do you do in a case like that?
I would think in situations that we would, and we want to make sure, and that's one reason for the idea of revising the rules and just what I said, is to allow us the clear authority to ask for additional information when we have a situation like you're talking about.
Okay. Did I hear you mention anything about the first item on our agenda today, change of ownership, or is it, or y'all, as far as y'all's recommendations? Y'all haven't teed up at all as far as any kind of...
No, I don't think we've teed up anything with regard to change of ownership.
You can't leave sleeping dogs lie, can you?
I think that's about it.
Okay, with that to think about, I would suggest we recess for lunch. Do we need additional time to draft some alternatives for the cap, or what's the wishes of the committee?
Yes.
1:15.
Our concerns with the variable of the production, you know, process improvement versus the emissions has to be addressed, and that caveat needs to be included in the language or in the rules that will give us some feeling of security that we're not going to lose, you know, that issue, because it is a major concern.
Okay. About 1:15 then. Is that sufficient time? All right, we'll come back at 1:15. We'll recess. Time. I'll entertain any additional discussion. I will say personally that I hear the concerns. I genuinely do hear the concerns of and I also have, I'm not motivated to have unintended consequences either. And that's, and if you think of it from my perspective, if it goes, maybe I'll step down on a limb here, but if it goes completely too far the other way, the legislature is obviously going to step in, and they're talking about that anyway. to tweak it. So I'm certainly not motivated to do that. With that in mind, if anybody, I think Mike had some language. I don't know if it's here yet. I don't think it is here yet. But if you want to kind of give some comments to introduce it before it gets here, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a shot, a beginning stages. I think in hopes of facilitating the staff to be able to do this timely, in other words, not have to take all weekend, I crafted it in a way that it is a statement of the committee that proposes something that could be included in the preamble, and the quotation of what could be included in the preamble you'll get in writing here. And it's basically a comment about that the committee, the statement of the committee is that we have considered the matter and agreed that uniformity doesn't necessarily mean that we have a single equation, that we think that the commission should use its discretion to develop multiple equations so long as they put those equations out for the understanding of the public, something to that effect. That's in there. That's at the beginning. And then we, in terms of what's in the preamble, it would be a commentary about, in addition to the inviting comments on the proposed revisions to the cap that we anticipate the staff is going to be proposing. Here it comes around. I'll read from this so that as everybody's getting it, they'll see it. So this is headed advice from TCEQ, Tax Exemption Advisory Committee. The committee agrees only one formula is not appropriate to calculate all partial use determinations. The committee advises TCEQ to include the following language in the preamble to the proposed rule. Regarding the proposed revisions to the cap, the commission invites comments on the proposed revisions as well as an alternative methodology the commission is considering in addition to or in place of the proposed revisions to the cap. The alternative methodology being considered as a typo is as follows, and then it lays out the calculation that Greg had handed out, I think last meeting, that we've been working with. The closing commentary says, we encourage comments. This would again continue to be preamble language that the commission would be saying to the public. We encourage comments on the following issues related to this methodology. What unintended consequences or abuses, if any, of the program would occur that do not align with the letter or intent of the constitutional or statutory language governing the program? 2, should operating hours be factored into this methodology? I mean, I'll acknowledge that some of this is really specific and some of it's broad. We probably would want to reorder it. But 2, should operating hours be factored into this methodology? What language, if any, should be added to prevent this methodology from being used to exempt an entire facility or a portion of pollution control property that has a production benefit? That's stated to make it clear that the commission is not intending that this equation could be used to that end, and that it's inviting comment about what language would be needed to ensure that that doesn't happen, both with regard to entire facilities and with regard to individual pieces of property, because I think we all agree that however this equation works, it's not intended to be a way for you to go to Tier 3 only to get back to Tier 1. I mean, if you're in Tier 3, you shouldn't be getting 100% under this methodology, in my opinion. So that's trying to reflect that. Should the commission, number 4, is should the commission apply this methodology to emission reductions as an average of all pollutants, proration, pollution of most concern, et cetera? We ran out of time to make that prettier, but to capture the two issues that Robert and Cyrus had flagged, the operating hours, and then which pollutant do you prioritize? There's probably a better way to say that. I defer to the agency about how they'd want to say that. One item that is not here, I didn't have time to include, that I'd open the floor to discuss, is a statement about an obvious, we also encourage alternative proposals, other methodologies that might be preferred.
One thing you could say is, instead of saying the alternative methodology being considered as follows, is you could say one of the alternatives.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. So it's not, I think that what's going to make some folks to my left some folks to my left concern would be the appearance that they're in any way in favor of this calculation.
Yeah.
As opposed to inviting comments on it. Would that be fair, or?
There's two suggestions. One,
their names are Smitty and Luke Metzger. Yeah, right.
I'm so glad he said that for me, but I'm also glad that Cyrus answered the question the way I would have. One suggestion, because I see that obviously, is you strike when you say as well as an alternative methodology. We might want to say as well as alternative methodologies the commission is considering in addition to or in place of the, and when it says the alternative, like Cyrus was saying, I would even say one alternative methodology that has been suggested, mm-hmm. to even weaken it. I'm not suggesting I want to make this sound like it's pre-wired. It really needs to sound like.
I would also suggest that I think the way I rewrote Greg's equation is easier to follow than having two separate equations, that you use that. Did you not look at my email?
I did. I don't
have my computer. And mine died. So let's talk about that. Do you have it written down?
Same thing, right?
Well, you go ahead and plug it in, and you end up with 1 minus 1 thing over another times 1 thing over another times 100. Just go ahead and do the substitution and rearranging it. It's easier to follow than. Greg, I think. Does Paul, do you have it there? No? Okay.
And the other question that could be put on the table, subject to what people think, is something about should, this is hard to write, should, and basically the idea of the marketable product, should marketable products be discounted from the proposed calculation? Sort of that question, if it is a sulfur recovery unit, does that matter, or does it not matter?
You know, I think this equation has the same problem that the one I gave y'all earlier does, in that it only is valid if your products for both processes are identical. If you have a byproduct, this does not work.
Yeah, the specific example I'm thinking of, and Mike might have a different perspective on this than I, is say it's for the carbon capture on the K list. And does it matter if you're capturing the carbon to put it underground, or if you're capturing it really as, you know, to create another product for oil recovery? It's still in both cases pollution control equipment, but in one you have more of an intent as also a production equipment, whereas in the other it's in one it's straight pollution control, in the other it's pollution control, but it's also to create a product for to be sold. That's the most obvious example I can think of, but there are probably others.
With making no concessions about how fervently I disagree with that position, I think it's okay to send it in the preamble for comment. I think that's what this is about. So we're not trying to predetermine what the outcome is. We're trying to invite comment on it.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how to ask. I'm not sure how to phrase that number 5, but it's that issue that I want to get at. Should any marketable products that result from the equipment, should the value of any marketable products be discounted from the formula, is basically the question that we'd invite comments on.
Or be considered
as part of the formula.
And did you want to say anything? We had talked, and everybody seemed to sort of nod in agreement that our, what do you call it, vehicle for coming up with the emissions would be the BTU of the fuel consumed. I don't know if you wanted to put that in this or not, but that's just, I just wanted to throw it out.
Well, I was thinking more of this, you know, the staff would put those kind of parameters around things in the measurement device instead of, you know, people cherry picking what they want out there in industry and saying, this is the what I'm going to use. And it's like, no, they.
Well, that's why I was saying use the fuel instead of.
Right.
Emissions here. So.
And the only reason I didn't try to write that, I agree with it. I think it's a great idea, and maybe staff can figure out a better way to do it, but in terms of how to write it. But I didn't want to leave the impression that this equation could only apply to air, because I think it's been crafted in a way that it's multimedia. We haven't talked about any other examples. That's one of the reasons we would ask for comments, and we might even say we solicit comments about. And we could say examples of classes of property that are inappropriate for use with this equation, or and then ask people about other media examples. Or I don't think we actually have to ask them. People will do it themselves because it's pretty clear that it's a multimedia thing. We've just only talked about air, so that's the reason I didn't.
Well, you could add a question that says, you know, should emissions be measured by, you know,
what's emission
pollutant by MMBTU, or by, you know, you could ask those questions by total pollution, by, you know, the rate of pollution, et cetera.
So add it as another item on 4?
Either add it as a second part of 4 or as its own item, whichever.
Is Wayne's equation going to be added to this thing?
If Greg doesn't have, if Greg and Paul, the technical guys, it's the same. I'm good with using Wayne's
language. I'm sorry. Maybe it's remedial math or something, but I'm not following this. It says environmental exemption percentage equals the words waste reduction or emissions reduction. So I'm looking for something that defines what emissions reduction or waste reduction is. And what am I overlooking? I'm not seeing it. Where's your definition? Where do you show the formula for emissions reduction or for waste reduction?
That is, the environmental exemption percentage is the right. Emissions reduction.
Or it could be a waste reduction.
But where does it say that here? I see something that defines environmental exemption percentage. Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking over here at emissions reduction, and then I was thinking, okay, now I'm going to get
Wayne's is actually, he's got it in one, okay. One formula basis, so, and we can make that. It'll, sorry.
If I understand this, I've got a $10 million production process that needs to be cleaned up, and I can either buy my stuff that cleans it up, or maybe I can throw the entire process out and I can put in a new process. And a new process does my things for me that I want it to do, and it emits only 25% of the emissions that the prior process did. Let's say instead of the $10 million what the prior process was, it's $20 million. Does that mean I get a 75% tax break?
No, because, I mean, you know, if that's the example you're looking at on that one, then it would be, you know, in this equation, you could put
I changed my numbers from the one I talked to you about.
Yeah, just because it was 100% before. I understand. Yeah. But I mean, it also goes back to you could take, here's my 10 man, here's my 20, and I'm replacing it, right? So there's a cost differential there from the original side, what we're talking about, because your production doesn't really change, right?
Right. Production's the same.
Same thing.
Production's the same.
But your emissions are different.
But I've replaced a $10 million process with a $20 million process that emits only 25% of what the $10 million process emitted.
And you're mandated or whatever you're doing
right.
To do that.
Now, under the current formula, you would still pay taxes on 50% of it, $20 million. And you would get a $10 million exemption. The way I understand this formula works is you would now get a 75% exemption.
Not necessarily true. I think I'm back to where it's...
And tell me what language in here says you don't get that.
I mean, you could take it, look at it in the opposite effect. Let's say you had a $10 million process and you replaced it with a $5 million process and you had the same percentage, 25%.
Go back to his example. Tell him why it doesn't...
Because there's a cost differential. I mean, you still... I'm not saying this is...
This doesn't have any cost differential.
This takes cost differential.
I understand that. I understand that. But what are you trying to get exempt? Some kind of cost, right?
It depends what you multiply the percentage by. Are you multiplying it by the whole plant or only
the equipment?
Only the equipment that leads to the pollution.
We're taking... Look, we've got a process. We got a... Or it could... You know, whatever. We got a process. We got a thing here. A widget maker. The widget maker produces 100 units of pollution. Cost, it has a value of $10 million. The regulators come in and say, you've got to get your emissions down to 25 units. And instead of putting stuff on that we know is all exempt, you say, you know what, I'm going to take the whole thing down and put a new process in that produces my widgets and only has 25 units of pollution. The way I read this, now we become a 75% exempt.
Right, okay, on the equipment that you could have put in that you didn't,
well,
how much does that cost?
I had equipment there. It was $10.
No, but to fix your existing equipment.
Your equation does not take into account the difference in cost.
I understand that.
But why do you keep bringing it up? Because your equation doesn't cover his case.
Well, I mean, the other case is not covered all the way around, too. I mean, those are some of the things that you've got to put into it. And you have to apply it to something. No. You have to figure that out.
I think it is covered. I think existing policy and rules say, all right, in order to reduce your emissions down to 25, you can put stuff on, and what you put on is exempt. Or you can change your process out, and the difference between the value of what you had before and what you spent now is exempt.
What happens if that cost is lower? You replaced your process with your $10 million process with a $5 million process.
And your tax bill went down by $5 million.
You're saying it's 100% exempt even though you have a production benefit.
You took the property away. Yeah, it's exempt. It doesn't exist. It doesn't need an exemption.
Your existing process, you're still producing the same amount with
$5 million process.
You're
proposing the replacement of the $10 million process with a $5 million process. So your valuation goes down to $5 million.
But it's reducing it pollution by X amount of percentage. So you're going to give it another?
No, I don't think the current cap gives it anything.
I think the question is, Don, does this formula, what does it apply to once you get the percentage? So on my example of the IGCC plant, I would assume it would apply to the front-end IGCC stuff that was leading to those that reduced pollution, not to the whole plant itself, not to the whole, you know, syngas product, you know, it would just be sort of the front end, like, or in a natural gas plant, it would be the percentage that you would apply to the Herzeg, which was giving you that efficiency, not to everything in the plant.
We have examples of applications.
Oh, I know.
Of folks taking out a piece of equipment that pollutes, that they need to produce widgets with, and replacing it with a piece of equipment that does not pollute, that they use to produce widgets with. We know those applications take place. We know that happens.
So that's 100%.
No, but he just said
it produces no pollution.
That's my point.
Under that process, wouldn't people file that under a Tier 2?
Now, look. Here's the whole point.
It is that exact situation is why Tier 3 was created.
Don, do you have any I don't know who told me the example about the spray cans. Was that you or
no.
where they have? Well, no, that's a product example. Excuse me.
The best example we have is the Freeport Energy Center Electric Power Generation Application, 07-11994, where they used basically a somewhat similar formula. They said, "We used to emit 147 parts per million, then we replaced our whole energy facility to produce energy, I assume, for some sort of refinery or something, and now we're only producing three, so therefore, 98% of the cost of both the HIRZEG and the actual turbine should be taken off the tax rolls." And so I guess one question would be, if we were to take this formula, you know, did they do it, is this the way we would apply it, or would we apply it much more narrowly than their much broader? And we've got an example right here, which was one of the ones on the table out there. You know, and my argument would be, they didn't apply it correctly because they're doing the condenser and ancillary pump system, the steam turbine, and the heat recovery, when really they should have just been looking at the heat recovery.
If we make someone reduce their, if we make someone put in $10 million, replace their $10 million process with a $20 million process in order to reduce emissions by 10%, then we give them 10% of that new, but if we make them reduce it by 50%, we give them 50% new. I'm just not getting this correlation, this nexus between the percentage of emission reduction and the amount of exempt property. I'm just not getting the nexus.
I see y'all blank, but I'm getting his message, you know, it should have been somewhere in it had the difference in first cost, which this does not.
But if you reduce it from a 10 million to a 5 million, your example.
We didn't make you put more on, we made you take stuff away. We don't have more property to tax. The idea was not to increase your taxes because of additional investment. And you're telling me, well, what happens if we make less investment?
Well, you get less taxes.
You get less taxes.
But it's still the existing investment was there, you took it away. Well, in this place, you replaced it, is what he was saying.
We won't tax it. How about this? We'll make what you take away 100% tax-free.
Rightly so. It's not fair. Take away anything, pollution is all high, it's not taxable.
I would invite people to look at this application and Brazoria and Dow Chemical Company's explanation of how they came up with a 98% tax exemption, and maybe we can discuss whether, because basically they're using a new emissions versus an old formula. It's not quite the same formula because they don't talk about the capacity, but.
Sorry, so I'm familiar with that one. I authored it, but I don't work for that company anymore because I'm retired from Dow Chemical. That one's sort of unique because a plant literally was shut down. That the capacity in that plant is exactly the same as what the prior one is. So
you just did a straight emissions reduction. It went from 147 right. to 3, so that's 98%.
Right. Yeah, my memory is only so good here, but, you know, that percentage, I think the TCEQ was not granting any steam turbine approvals at that time, so that percentage would have been applied
only to the
to the HIRZEG part. So, but I'm not trying to represent that at this point. But I would like to make a comment. I can see how difficult this whole issue is, and I don't have all the history, and I don't claim to. But when I look back at when Tier 1 was set up, there was a certain number of applications that were 50%. And I'll say vent recovery was an example. And I think even at that time, you know, you could come up with all kinds of calculations about what the benefit might be from a vent recovery system, and I just wonder whether we're trying to overcalculate it and make it more precise than what our ability allows for all the cases. And honestly, back in 95, I thought the 50% was pretty good on certain types of equipment. I'm just throwing that out as a thought that, you know, is it a percentage that should be applicable for some scenarios that's uniform across to everybody? And yeah, some companies will make more money and some companies will make less money, you know, because they're trying to make money. But, you know, it's just a little bit out of the box thinking. Is there a list of percentages that would be applicable in certain scenarios as opposed to calculations?
Now, Leo, I agree that, you know, there's, and that's why you have that equipment list, is you can do that, but there are so many items that are not, how would you say, that are unique or relatively distinct from other ones that are similar, that you need something to be able to calculate it, so. But I agree with you that...
Yeah, my point was there was no calculation on vent condensers at the beginning of this process, and evidently somewhere in the years that was refined, but this group's kicked around a whole lot. We seem to be running around in a circle. You know, in my view, we either need to have two or three equations that somebody can draw on, and if those do not fit a certain set of facts, then it would be the taxpayer's responsibility to come up with the new, you know, a new appropriate way to calculate it. And I think the only way to be uniform is for the group doing the use determinations, you know, evaluation to be as consistent as they can, because everybody's facts are different, you know.
I really have a problem with this particular equation, and I didn't have as bad a problem until I started listening to some of Don's examples he just said. There needs to be a whole bunch more stuff around this to prevent it from being, prevent it from doing strange things when you look at certain cases. And I would feel terribly uncomfortable about voting for even putting this out as, you know, we can invite people to give us equations, but I don't want to put this one out there because it's just, it's got too many cases where it says,
I mean, it's tough because I know what Don's talking about, you know, and I keep wrestling with production benefit or increased production benefit.
Well, and but if he's got the same production benefit and
then you're required to do it, then I understand that. And if you have an increased production benefit, then you don't want to give him a benefit for an increased production. I understand that.
But the thing is if he had a $10 million piece of equipment, the most you should exempt is some portion of the additional $10 million he'd have to spend
above and beyond.
Right, which this doesn't cover that.
Well, it doesn't not cover it. It just doesn't cover.
You really
cover
confused me there. I thought his example was the $10 million was replaced, which means the $10 million went to zero.
Right.
And then you added $5
million. Well, no. He put in $20 million piece of equipment to replace a $10 million piece of equipment. But this, then you would have a 75% reduction in the property value, which would mean that would, you know, you would be reducing more than what you had there originally. It would
if we make you spend 90% more money to reduce emissions by 5% to get into compliance, you get 5% reduction. If we make you spend 5% more to get 90% reduction in order to get in compliance, we reduce your exemptions 90%. There's just
logic.
Yeah, it
there's
just
no connection between the percentage of emission reduction and the amount of money you're having to spend. We need to determine how much additional cost capital are you putting into pollution control and not widget production, and exempt that?
But is that based on a comparable, or is that based on the piece of equipment? Because who cares about the comparable? You just want the piece of equipment, right?
If it's the piece of equipment, then we have way, I mean, that's the easy part of this. The hard part of this is replacement processes that are more efficient or more clean, maybe just produce the widget in a complete different way so as not to pollute. That's what Tier 3 wrestles with.
If you wanted something that worked better, why don't you look at the equation I handed out in the beginning and take out the operating cost and put in the emissions in place of the operating cost. Now, somebody will argue about the life of the equipment. You may not want to include that, but it does include the first cost portion if you... That Greg's does not.
I think we need to get back to what John said earlier. I wish he'd be here, but basically the reason the whole thing came about was to keep industry, keep companies from having to incur cost when they install a piece of pollution control equipment. And I think that's what we got to get focused back on some kind of way. What is the cost of that pollution control equipment? And you do have to look at the profit benefit that they're going to be having. You know, if it's a self-recovery unit, you still got to have to look at that. You've got to look at what part of it is production.
Well, I think more simply is what portion is pollution control and what portion is production.
I agree with that, but this doesn't hit the production. This is just
that doesn't help you with that, does it?
It's not related to it. If we make you put on 50% more cap, 50% more capital into something to reduce your emissions by 2% in order to get in compliance, you shouldn't get a 2% exemption, you get a 50% exemption.
Yeah, but see what I understand, if it reduces it 2%, but the whole piece of that equipment is designed to reduce it 2%, then that's 100%.
I agree with you. But if that's the case, we're not dealing with this equation.
And that's what I'm wrestling with. I'm trying to figure out, how do you distinguish between production and pollution and how it's all integrated? And
if... Correct me, I'm going to ask the staff to correct me if I don't have this right, if I don't say this right. The current process, if you have equipment that controls pollution, then you file and you identify that equipment and you guys agree and you grant an exemption for that equipment. But you can also come in and say, I've got replacement or new stuff that I produce widgets with that also helps me control pollution and meet environmental regulations. That's the partial exemption that has been at the heart of our discussions around this for 15 years. And that's what we're dealing with. When we can't identify a piece of equipment that is controlling the pollution, but you're using your property in a different, you've got more capital in play, you spent to produce your widgets with less pollution. And you can't pick the one piece of equipment. The classic example, and y'all heard me use this one, was replacing a gas-fired pump with an electric pump.
Could I ask staff if they're at liberty, or if you feel comfortable telling us the pros and cons of this versus the pros and cons of what we have now? Is that too much of a burden to put on you at this time?
or if you know of anything that would suggest I'm wrong, or know of anything that's, you know, in other words, do you have any insight into this?
Well, if you have any insight, not that you would, I can't help but wonder if something like this goes forward, would it be acceptable by the executive director and the commissioners? Or is it a non-starter? And I don't know if you're willing to comment on that yet.
I don't know if I don't think I can comment on that.
Okay.
I just don't know. I mean, all the stuff that you all are talking about is kind of same stuff that we've been thinking about and how to do it and struggling with, and I mean, it's just not easy, and that's why we have this problem. I mean, from my perspective, it seems like the act, we have to deal with pollution reductions and production, and you know, in a lot of cases, when you have an integrated unit, those two things have nothing to do with each other. And it's really difficult to get your head around just how to deal with a cap that's going to appropriately deal with everything. And
well, from your experience, is there a myriad of examples where you need multiple formulas, or would one or two handle 80% of them or more? Or I guess we're trying to fix most of the big issues. I don't know if we can fix everything today. In other words, improve the process.
You know, if there are examples of certain things and categories of equipment, and this is just me talking, and I don't know how even the guys sitting over here are going to respond to this, but if there are categories of equipment that you can look at that are like, well, this is energy efficiency, maybe there's an equation that you could come up with that you know, there's two or three different equations I guess that you could come up with. I guess some of the basic questions that we ask ourselves, should we be taking marketable product? Should we be taking the concept of marketable product? Just because you're making money on a piece of equipment that reduces pollution control, should we be addressing that? It seems to me that's a basic question that is going to come up in equations. And then how do we just distinguish? How do we deal with things other than air pollution? We really haven't talked about some of those other things and how an equation would work for that. And even we even think of emissions reduction as examples more than any other examples, because quite frankly, that's pretty much the only ones that have come up to us, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sorry, I don't know. If there are categories of equations that we could develop, that would be fine. But then you have to, some things I've thought about was, well, say you have a cap that deals with cost. Say you have another one that deals with energy efficiency and maybe emission reductions or something. Those two things aren't at all similar. and so they're not consistent across the board. And is it right to deal with one equation for one set of activities in one way that bears no resemblance to the other way you do it? We've thought about.
Could be. I just thought this. Maybe part of the answer is to add more to tier one with partial exemptions, like has been there in the past, like 50%. Somebody mentioned. Apparently, someone calculated the basis way back, or maybe they just pulled it out of the air. I don't know, but
you know, actually, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Steph, because I wasn't at those meetings. Some of you guys were, I think, but I think a lot of those things were discussed around the table, and somebody said, well, you know, 30% sounds pretty good, and everybody said, okay, 30%. But when we go back now, and that was part of our discussions earlier, when we go back now and we try to find some justification for that 30%, we don't have that 30% justification.
Well, I guess I'm taking this a different direction, but if we took the common items, for example, maybe we ought to think of a formula that applied to that item and then come up with a reasonable percentage for that item and then kind of work through it that way. And I don't know how much of the applications we could, that would address. I don't know. But here we are at 2:00 on Friday afternoon before the, you have to get it to management on Monday. What do we do?
You know, it appears that there's lack of 100% agreement. You know, if we could just come up with, say, now Wayne, I can't quote your formula here because I don't have it in front of me, but say Wayne's formula or one's portion of the group here prefers, and then the other formula, and I think summarize it that opinions are split on this and just call it like it is. I think we're trying to force two potential views for this through the same opening, and we're not going to agree on them, I don't believe. Not today.
So you're saying a majority opinion and a minority opinion is better than no action at all?
Well, I'd say two opinions.
Or just say, add, you know, one of the alternative methodologies being considered is this, have this, and then another methodology is being considered, and put the one that Wayne came in, put it out there. Or do you think that's just, that's not going to be helpful?
Group can do what it wants to do. For me, I would be hesitant to put something out there or recommend to the commission put something out there that I don't think makes sense. That I don't think has a reasonable or logical nexus to the statute or to what we're trying to do or to the purposes of the program. It doesn't make sense to me to throw out a formula that says that a business that has to increase their investment by 50% to get 1% reduction that's required should only get a 1% exemption, and that a business that has to increase investment by 1% to get a 50% should get a 50% exemption. And that's what this says. That's right. How this formula works. And so I don't see the sense in putting that out there.
Well, I mean, I'll just comment that the regulations are stated in terms of emission goals or waste reduction or water quality. How people choose to get there is their choice. They spend $1 million, $1 billion, $100,000. I think the heart and soul of this equation is that when the agency is factoring in, it's going to stick to what it knows. It's not going to get into valuations. It's not going to talk about cost, as John talked about. I think John's comment about the origin of the statute was that we're not going to burden people. Here he is. We're not going to burden people with paying taxes on that additional investment. It's not that I don't think that statute's designed to go into whether it costs them money. It's about whether we're asking them to pay a tax on the additional value. Okay, that's to me, as a political scientist, that makes sense to me. Are we spreading that burden, or is that person carrying that tax burden? I mean, at one level, I'd like to say to you that if that guy who is going after a 2% reduction can't do it more efficiently than the other guy, then this equation probably works out, that he doesn't get rewarded for spending too much money fixing the problem. I mean, I'm okay with putting some language in here, like a lot of language, and I've got some other ideas about, we want all your ideas about what's good, bad. Maybe this needs to get thrown out, but I'm not offended by this as being so far afield from a methodology that the agency could figure out how to apply. I think the idea that Leo, I think, has touched upon, and Weiner maybe touched upon, which is we may come up after we start crunching numbers with classes of equipment where a certain type of equation applies. I think that's a good approach.
Let me ask you, did any of you sit down and change the input numbers on some specific thing, like saying cutting the emissions in half and seeing what Greg's equation does, or changing the, did you ever sit down and change the variables and see what it did? Because I gave you a spreadsheet you could do that with.
And there are occasions when it flat out fails to do what you think it ought to do.
Right. Exactly.
And again, that highlights that one formula doesn't work for everything.
Well, and my problem is the one you're trying to put out here fails in a lot of cases. That's why I sat down and redid this, because I put it where, you know, you raise the first cost, you get more exemption. If you just everything moves the right direction with that, but Greg's it doesn't.
I was going to ask staff to clarify again, if you can tell us what's going to be published in the cap, what changes.
I think you probably can expect to see that the marketable product calculation is going to be what will be in the rule package, and I'll say that's only because that's generally where the process seemed to start with the legislature last year in 3206. The OBB basically proposed something like that without even realizing that I think they thought that we didn't need to change our rules at all to do that. That's not what actually ended up in 3206. Language of 3206 doesn't say that. It did when it started out in legislature. But that's the simplest way. We're comfortable with the byproduct calculation, with the cap right now. Understanding it might not work in all situations. I mean, but generally, I mean, sincerely, that's, and I'm not putting it off on you all. It's a difficult problem, but that's why we highlighted this as an issue to start off the discussions of the advisory committee.
And calculated in a similar way as the byproduct is now, but you're using a marketable product. You're expanding it.
I think we showed you pretty much
okay
what we were thinking.
And, you know, I just would, and I, Minor, you heard me say this before, the fact that that language wasn't included in the final legislation is in and of itself telling. I don't think that you can read too much into it. I think it's absolutely within the commission's discretion and staff's appropriate to try to flesh out something that maybe goes toward what they think the intent is. And earlier today, I was suggesting that the solicitation of comment that be included in the preamble not even include the details. If, you know, I know it doesn't put staff in as good a position as they'd like, but I like the idea of saying we solicit comments about emission-based, you know, calculations as compared to cost-based. We also solicit comments about whether the public believes that the cost of the equipment should even be factored in. We clearly have heard from a constituency that does not believe that cost should be factored in. There are others that disagree with that. I think the commission's actually made an assumption that you can peek over the fence and look at the value of these properties, which may be a healthy thing to actually have comment about.
I could support an open-ended solicitation of comments on ways to improve the cap.
Yeah, I would put words. I would try to guide the topics we have talked about around. We spent a lot of time talking about them. I think we could put words together about emission-based versus the approach that's currently contemplated in the cap, even as revised, because there's different methodologies there, and I think we should put the public on notice of what we're talking about, or else we will put the staff in a position of saying we've never told people we were going to consider that.
I don't, I think you start talking about emissions-based when you start talking about lots of other things. I think I would feel comfortable with an open-ended solicitation of comments on ways to improve the cap. But if we're going to start talking about one, then we need to talk about just making sure we include marketable products. I mean, I think we need, we're going to, anyway, I thought that as a possible way to move forward would be to have a more general open-ended solicitation for ideas on ways to improve the cap.
And one option that was commented on several meetings ago, or a couple of meetings ago, is the NAICS code. If it's on the NAICS, listed as a product, that's their marketable product. Otherwise, it's a byproduct.
Yeah. There's a lot of... This, my concern is if we try to get into specifying out a lot of different ways to improve that any one perspective views as a way to improve the cap, well, then we're going to get in back to where we just came from. So
that brings me back to the question of is it better to not necessarily advise but update? I think that's part of our bylaws too, to update the commission on the various options that we're talking about, or ideas rather, and some of them we might not consider viable options. Or is it, since we were not making the decision, is it better to not comment at all? And I get the impression, and I don't have an overinflated view of the influence of our committee, but I get the impression that the commission might want to hear our thoughts and what we've been talking about.
I think the staff will be relating what we've talked about to the commission, correct? So I don't know that we have to make a specific comment to the commission, other than we hope the staff relays the various things that we've been discussing.
And I am required by bylaws, by the way, just to remind you to have, I think, an annual report to the commission.
It's not necessary.
I don't know if it specifies when in the year that's to be supplied, but I would think this could be an opportune time before the rulemaking process starts. I don't know.
I mean, I would just to be practical, and everybody's got someplace to go, hopefully home. The commission needs to hear, staff needs to hear from us today if we want something in the package that gets, I think realistically, can be presented to the commissioners at the agenda, because they don't really want to put in things after it's released to the public. That seems like a good idea. So we could probably pretty quickly come to agreement about what one or two sentences we would actually recommend be included in the preamble, because we actually have reached agreement about one principle. I don't think it's inconsequential, and that is that we don't view the statute as requiring one formula. That might be news to the commissioners. And I think it would be good for us to say, as a committee, like we've done, I think pretty consistently actually been able to get unanimous votes, hey, we haven't solved all the problems, but we agree about a couple of things. One is that we don't think the statute requires one equation. We think you should solicit comments about alternatives to the cap as you've proposed it to be revised, period. I'm not looking to steamroll the alternative.
Is that a motion?
So I'll make that motion.
I second it.
Okay. And for discussion, if anybody comes up with the magic widget between now and the agenda, we'll give it to Bob. He'll put it in an email. We'll take a vote. And maybe we have something to offer to the commissioners. But absent that, I don't think we should kill ourselves trying to fix it. I don't think anybody...
Okay. That was very quick with a motion and a second. So it's open for discussion. And I would suggest that we only... In about 5 seconds, listed two items. Is there anything else that we agree on that we think we should?
Part of that motion was to go ahead and invite comment on alternative methods and approaches without mentioning them, but saying,
okay. I've got one is we agree there's not just one formula that applies to all, and secondly, solicit.
Let's word this carefully. We agree it's not necessary.
It's not necessarily
have to be one formula.
Doesn't mean we're saying there has to be more than one formula. It's saying it may be that you can use, you don't have to use just one formula.
Right, how about this language? So the committee agrees that the uniformity requirement in the governing statute does not require the commission to rely upon a single formula when calculating partial use determinations.
Agreed. Second that.
Okay.
It's not on an individual.
Well, yeah, we...
Okay.
All right, so I'll take that as a substitute motion over the previous motion.
Yeah, the other one was kind of free.
All right, actually, I guess you had to withdraw your...
I'll withdraw my prior motion.
Since you were the same one that made the...
I think I was coerced into that motion.
So the motion is, and reread that one more time, please.
That the committee agrees that the uniformity requirement in the governing statute does not require the commission to rely upon a single formula when calculating partial use determinations.
Agreed. Do we have a second? And any discussion? No discussion. We'll call for a vote. Those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
I'm writing it down, staff.
All right. Passes with no opposition.
The second motion I'd make
unanimous.
Is that...
There's one that's not here, right. So I can't say it's unanimous. There's one that's not here.
And my second motion would be that we add to that probably a second sentence that says that the committee recommends that the commission invite comments during the public comment period about alternative methodologies to supplement or replace the cap that is currently being used, including the revisions that are being proposed by the staff in the proposed rule. The revisions being proposed.
That was a long one.
Yeah, write it. See if you can write it down and say it all again.
That's the test.
That the committee recommends that the commission invite comment. Yeah, that'd be good. Waiting for somebody who's got a fresh battery to start typing. Because I'm writing the other one. That the commission, we recommend that the commission invite comments during the public comment period regarding alternative methodologies for calculating partial use determinations to supplement or replace the cap as it is proposed to be revised in the proposed rule. You guys can make that actually sound like English. But I mean, it's enough to convey a message, I think, that we're asking for alternative. Did you get that?
I'm working on the last part of it.
Do you have a second?
Is that a motion? A second.
I'm okay. They'll figure out a better way to say it. That's why we're not decision makers. We're just advisors.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion?
No. I'll be glad to do that. We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? We'll call a vote. Before I do that, I'll read the motion again. That the commission invite comments during the public comment period regarding alternative methodologies for calculating partial use determinations to supplement or replace the cap as it is proposed to be revised in the proposed rule. Got proposed twice there, but that's all right. All right. Any further discussion? Those in favor say aye.
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 No? Motion carries.
Good work, Mark.
May I move that we adjourn? Oh, should we have another meeting scheduled first?
Well, let me formally go through the agenda right quick. Just real quick. Old business, new business.
Did we vote to approve the minutes from the last meeting?
We did not.
and I think I dropped the ball on that. It was distributed, the minutes were distributed. Do we have a motion on that?
What's the date on that? Remind me of the date.
We were going to vote on email, and I'll...
Oh, we could vote on email, but we can, it's okay to vote in this meeting.
I think so. The purpose of the email was to hopefully get it on the website quicker, but since we're here.
Motion to approve the minutes from the May 21st meeting.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion? We'll call the vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries. Any comments? I would like to hear from staff one more time so everybody's clear. Probably better to hear from, well, I'll just make a stab at it.
Bob, real quick, do we get to take an official vote on the revised April 12th meeting minutes?
We did it by email, right?
Okay, that's what I was at. Okay, yeah, right. We did.
But it's my understanding these the rules will be published next Friday, the 11th, and it'll be on the agenda for June 30th, the commission, and then the public. I see June 11th. That's when it goes in the Texas Register, right? No. Oh, the commission has to vote on it first.
Yes, it'll be on the website. Anything else? It'll just be on our website, correct?
So does the 30 days start in the Texas Register? Okay, so far. So in effect, we have until July 11th June 11th until the end of July to review the rules. In effect, so.
Could somebody possibly send us a direct link to that when y'all get it published, without having to go through all the?
Okay, great. Any other comments from the public? Thanks for coming again. Any other comments from the committee? Future meetings, we can talk about it. I don't know if we need to meet again before the June 30th meeting.
I think we need to meet between June 11th and the end of the 30-day period to get our ducks in a row. 60 or 30?
30. After from the publication. After 30 days.
All right. So you want to meet between June 11th and the 30th? I think that's...
Cecilia.
So we need to meet in before the end of July, so that we have a couple weeks to file comments before the end of the comment period is
committed. So wouldn't that be comments as individuals as opposed to committees? It's possible. The question is, do we want to give ourselves as a committee the opportunity to file comments as a committee? I know. I expect everyone here will file individual comments.
My perception is the commission might take more might look at it a little closer if it's the committees, but that's not to say that individuals can't comment.
I think, especially because I think the great job of keeping this committee working together, identifying where we have consensus among what I think is a fairly diverse and group of stakeholders, that covers a large degree of the waterfront of stakeholders on this program. So I think when this committee speaks, I think it speaks to some other meaning behind that.
All right, so.
Mainly because you've done a great job of keeping us speaking to consensus, and I want to thank you for that. I think it's makes an effective thing that when we can't agree, we can all fight this before.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate the comments. So I'll go back to, do we want to meet between June 11th and June 30th?
Yes.
or just wait until afterwards?
What is the last day for us to have input?
That'd be a...
It's 30 days from when?
Right, yeah, it would be, but we would want to get all comments by the end of the comment period, so July 30th.
July 30th is absolute deadline?
Well, that'll be the end of the... I'm sorry?
It'll be 2 weeks later. It would have ended August 2nd, so it'd be August 16th will be the end of the comment period, assuming publication is within normal time.
So that's taken into account TR publication.
So if we met on July 30th, it would be acceptable? And if we came up with something?
Yeah,
how about let's look at our calendars in the last couple of weeks of July.
Okay.
And
let's just to make sure I have the schedule right. Our point would be if we're going to make official comments, that period is not before the meeting on the 30th.
Right. Of June.
It's not before then.
Right.
It's before 30 days. After that point.
It actually would go to August the 6th, right, Joe?
16th.
If he's doing that.
It was the 2nd, so it'd be the 16th. I don't know if it makes sense to meet right before the commission meets, because we can't do anything that's really then before we get input to them on that. I just probably want to hear the discussion by the commissioners.
On June 30th.
On June 30th, yeah.
And then we'll have what's published. We'll see what the commission has done. They'll publish what they're going to publish. We'll comment on that. But I don't think it makes sense to meet to comment on that before they meet and adopt it for publication.
Right.
I think everybody can do that on June 30th, right? So what I was proposing is July 30th.
Yeah, something in July. I just ask that we do it in mid-June because vacation. But
well, Jay, June and July, I understand.
Mike, when is your vacation so we can schedule it?
How about July 16th?
Well, let's...
Are you going to do that by email?
Yeah. Okay. Let's check our calendars. And I want to include John in those too.
Right. I mean, my thought is that mid-July gives us plenty of time to work something up, but leaves enough time if we actually have more...
In case we need to meet again.
Well, I don't even know if we need to meet, but if, you know, some number crunching, if somebody comes up with the magic widget, I would want us some time to run it. I mean, we've clearly proven that it takes, you can't just do it live here at the agenda, you know, when it comes to these equations. So we're going to need some time after that. I don't know that we'll need to meet again, but we'll definitely want the smart people to be able to run the numbers. So
okay,
it's not just because of vacation. I think we should shoot for mid-July.
All right.
My suggestion, I agree with Mike saying, we do have to do the number crunch before we get here, but I really think it's a good idea for us to meet face-to-face before we do it finally.
All right. I hear you.
I agree.
Okay. There should be an S.
Any other?
Had a typo.
Any other comments?
S.
Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All right. Those approved, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries. We're adjourned.
It was actually Bob's side, though.
It was me. I'll take the heat for it.
Oh, okay. I don't want to type that.